norming it, honorable chair, it's with you myself only. Thank you.
I request MEC Ngata to introduce his delegation and then take it from there. If he starts, that's fine. If he delegates to anybody to lead the presentation, so be it. Thank you very much, Honorable MEC Ngata.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to you, Honorable Chair, and Honorable members of the committee and support staff of the committee, and compliments of the new year. And the Chair has explained the fact that I'm acting for MEC Kopa, who's not well. We wish to thank this opportunity given to the province, to the department by the portfolio committee. And with me, I'm with the acting SG or HOD of the department, Dr. Zungu, and other senior managers. With the permission of your chair, I would like to give an opportunity to present the report, which will cover the COVID-19 cases, bed availability, COVID-19 admission, oxygen status in the province, and the lab testing, circumcision update as to how far we are now, and then testing of mortal remains, and medicine and PPE availability, and vaccination rollout, and what the province is busy doing now to get the program ready. With your permission, Honorable Chair, I would like to hand over to HPD as well.
Thank you, Chair, honorable members, and our MEC. I'm going to request, Chair, because of my unstable network, to switch off my video and then proceed with the presentation. The secretariat, I'm requesting them to fly to the presentation for me. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. We may move to the next slide. We can go to slide number 4 because the Honorable MEC had highlighted the profile of the presentation. So as of yesterday, the province had 182,507 cases, and we have 9,036 deaths. And we have 1,705 admissions to date distributed in different areas of our health facilities. Our recovery rate as of the 9th of January is at 91%, and the positivity rate for the province is at 24.4%. In the next slide, we're showing the trends in the province with the resurgence of the infection that we observed, and our infections for the second wave seemed to peak somewhere in the middle of December, but the rise in the new infections is happening at different districts at different times, making the second wave to be broader and to last a bit longer than the first wave. If we move to the next slide, we are going to then see how the weekly incidence of cases in the province has moved with the weeks of the epidemic. We also see that if we look at the blue line that shows the incidence, the numbers of cases per 100,000, we will see that the cases in the province are on a downward trend, even though we do have some provinces that we are concerned about. The major contributors to the epidemic in the Eastern Cape were Nelson Mandela Bay Metro and Sarah Batman, and these two districts accounted for almost 70 to 80% of the number of new cases in the province at the beginning of December. And at this point, we've seen a consistent decline since around the middle of December. So at this point, the province is on a decline, with only one district that has cases that are on the rise, and this is the only district that is not declared a hotspot, which is Sarah Batman. Which is Joe district. And as we will see in the next slide, the numbers are for 11 January. The cases in the districts are outlined, and we have also outlined these cases with a population estimates, so using the Census A mid-year population estimates for 2020. And we can see that districts like Joe Gabi at this point have a high number of cases, and yet the population is much less. If you were to compare the number of active cases as well as the number of confirmed cases in the fourth column, the number of confirmed cases at Joe Gabi are much higher if you compare the population of Joe Gabi and Alfred Nzo. And in the rest of the province, we can see that the districts that are under pressure is Buffalo City Metro and Joe Gabi District and Chris Hani to some extent. In the next slide, we are going district by district, looking at the active cases and the recoveries. And again, we can see a concerning picture in terms of the numbers of deaths. Nelson Mandela Bay Metro still continues to record a high number of deaths in the province, followed by Buffalo City Metro and Chris Hani District. And those three are our major areas of concern in relation to the numbers of deaths. In the next slide, we look at the impact of COVID-19 in the health workers. And to date, 9,249 health workers in different categories have tested positive, and we have lost 161 healthcare workers. And we have outlined the numbers by districts, and again, Buffalo City Metro and Nelson Mandela Metro are showing the high numbers in the province. Then we move to the bed status, and when we structured our presentation, we looked at the health system issues, and we looked at our bed status.
Okay, where are you calling from?
We are only going to take Dr. Zungu's voice for now. Any other voice, please mute your mic.
Thank you, Chair. At this point, we are reflecting the position of the province in terms of the availability of beds in relation to the admissions in the province. And we've categorized them according to general beds as well as critical care beds. And we are concerned in three districts in terms of the availability of general beds for Alfred Nzo, Buffalo City Metro and OR Tambo. As of yesterday, because we monitored the bed availability on a daily basis, as of yesterday, these three were showing pressure on the general beds. And when we move to the critical care beds, and looking at Alfred Nzo and Joe Gabi, and the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro, there is some pressure that we are seeing there in terms of critical care beds. The other challenge that we have, which we need to bring to the attention of the National Portfolio Committee, is that districts like Alfred Nzo, Amatole, Joe Gabi, and Sarah Batman do not have designated ICU facilities. However, the province has made a provision of critical care beds through what we once presented to this committee in terms of the hubs and spokes, where we are designating certain district hospitals and equipping them with oxygen and high flow equipment and better staffing levels to ensure that the citizen of the province can travel to a critical care bed within two hours with an ambulance. In the next slide, we are then reflecting on the admissions. As indicated earlier, we have, as of the 11th of January, we had 1,732 admissions distributed in different areas in the health facilities. The following slide shows how the admissions are distributed. With 1,524 being in the general wards, and 144 being in ICU, and 64 in high care. And 855 of these admissions, we have them on oxygen, whether they are in high care or in the general wards, and 76 of them are ventilated. In the next slide, we are showing the outcomes of our admissions, and to date, we have had 15,705 patients discharged from admission out of the 25,385 that we have ever admitted for COVID-19. Unfortunately, we lost 7,206. And currently we have 1,732 that are still in admission. In the next slide, then, we look at the issue of staffing, because we can have the beds, but if we don't have the staff, it doesn't assist us. We have looked at critical posts that we have rationalized given our financial constraints, and we prioritized the absorption of community service officers, and also we prioritized the critical leadership positions. The appointment of CEOs where the positions are still vacant, and because of our financial position, we are waiting for the 1st of April to do the appointments. Otherwise, in most of the cases, interviews and the process has already been done. And the clinical cadres with the professional nurses, we have over 640 that will be finishing community service in April, and we will be absorbing them at that point when they finish community service. And we are also looking at staffing for our medical legal cases as well as the general COVID-19 clinical work. In the next slide, we are reflecting then on the work that we have done. The province opted to absorb all community service officers that did their community service in the province, and because we do have a challenge with recruitment, and that has made us gain 302 staff members in different categories. Of note is that actually we have 311 if we count those that were non-bursary holders. And this has given us 111 medical officers. We have reflected on the slide 90 that were bursary holders. And we also have gained physiotherapists and radiographers that will help us for our work in the 28 facilities that we have outlined as hubs. Then we are looking at the oxygen program, which is also critical in the management of COVID-19 patients. in this regard, we are highlighting that for the festive season, the province had a plan that was created to ensure that throughout the festive season, we do not run out of supplies of oxygen. And we negotiated with AFROX to be able to collect cylinders over weekends and public holidays, and also to ensure that we monitor our oxygen in all the areas. The festive plan of the Eastern Cape ran from the first week of December right up to the end of January, catering for eventualities with people returning to work, schools opening, as well as universities opening. In the next slide, then, we start to highlight the timeline for the installations of the bulk oxygen in a number of district hospitals that otherwise did not have, realizing that the equipment for management of COVID-19 patients requires high flow oxygen, and also patients remain on oxygen for longer periods, and these facilities that are listed over the different months have been having a bulk the installation of bulk oxygen tanks. At the bottom, we have those that are still coming in for bulk oxygen that are delayed by the situation with the industries and the manufacturers not yet open at this point. What we have then in the next slide is a further illustration of the areas that we are going to be working on, especially in the eastern part of the province, where we have rurality being a factor. And we are therefore ensuring that we are installing bulk oxygen in those areas, and also looking at Chrisani, that is showing a high number of cases. Alwal North is for Jokabi district, which is the district that is still showing an increase in the numbers of new cases that are detected. The next slide is almost similar to the previous one, but it is just further highlighting the mitigating steps that the province took to ensure that there is close monitoring of the availability of oxygen, as well as the ensuring that the delivery mechanisms are improved. And then again, if we go to the following slide, we are continuing on the issues of the oxygen and showing what is a challenge where we are still yet to install the oxygen, and the work that we have done to try and mitigate those challenges. In the next slide, we're highlighting a challenge that we have with our sole supplier of oxygen, which is AFROX. At this point, AFROX has issued us with a letter indicating that their capacity to supply is under strain, and releasing us to collect or to procure oxygen from other suppliers, which is a little bit of a challenge at this point, because the other suppliers are also stretched. But we have engaged our treasury for this work, and at the same time, we are ensuring that the challenges that AFROX has, we try to mitigate them ourselves by getting our own transport, our own trucks to collect the cylinders for our facilities in the periphery. And we are ensuring that each and every facility reports raises a flag when there is an issue of oxygen that is highlighted. And we have distributed our equipment such that we do not exhaust oxygen with some high flow equipment in the hospitals in the periphery that do not yet have the tanks. However, we have provided them with oxygen concentrators to ensure that whilst awaiting transportation, the primary healthcare and first level district hospitals can do some intervention. We are also looking at engaging the SANDF to assist with the collection and distribution of oxygen in case our own capacity is exhausted. At this point, we are using our internal capacity to transport the cylinders in the province. The further work is indicated in the next slide. We are showing the work that we are doing with the distribution of oxygen, and also it must be mentioned that we have some of the equipment that we have received through donations. The recent ones were from the Gift of the Givers, but earlier on we had received donations from the Solidarity Fund and other non-governmental organizations, and it should be noted that some of the equipment that we have, like the Oxera, is the brainchild of our own medical officer who has the engineering skills also and works in the anesthetics department at Cecilia Makiwane Hospital, and he has contributed in the conceptualization of the Oxera equipment, which is quite important in the management of COVID-19 patients. I have already indicated, Chair, around the work that is we've done with Afrox to ensure that we can access cylinders throughout the week. In the next slide, we are going to be showing our capacity for laboratory testing. And here we are indicating just because of the rural nature of our province and also some of the rural towns and the challenges that they have in terms of the capacity for the health system. The laboratories in smaller towns like Mount Elif, Matatiel, and Alfredzo, we will see that the capacity there over a 24-hour period to do the test actually is quite low, and to ensure that the turnaround time for results is improved, we have since the 17th of November introduced the rapid antigen test. And where there are laboratories in the hospitals, the rapid antigen test has been introduced, and this has improved the capacity to test in these areas. And then also the vans do go to some of the areas that do not have laboratory tests on site. And this has been quite helpful to improve the capacity of the system for testing. In the next slide, we then show the concerns that we had, as indicated that from the middle of December, we started seeing a slight decline in the number of new cases. And we were quite concerned because as the cases were declining, the average, the 7-day moving average for tests was declining. And we were concerned, and we tried to ramp up the testing. However, it was just not happening, and we are grateful that we are seeing a consistent decline in the number of new cases with the improvement of the numbers of tests that are done since the 1st of January. And then we feel a little bit more confident to say indeed there is a decline in the new number of cases in the province because the testing rate has also improved. Then in the next slide, we are looking at the issue of testing of the mortal remains. It might look like something that is cumbersome, but given the rate of infections that we have had in our province since the policy was introduced, it really took off around October in the province because of the logistics. And we have tested 363 bodies at this point, and almost half of them were positive. And this has helped us to trace the contacts and intervene where we were still in time to intervene. In the next slide, Chair, we are showing a slight deviation that the province had in the approach to the exam, metric exam marking season. whilst the policy from Department of Basic Education was limiting the precautionary measures to screening, the province, given its status of the hotspot, the hotspot status, then with the joint work with Department of Education and organized labor, worked on an agreement that all examiners, when they present at a marking center, they should be having results that are not older than 72 hours. And in the process where they presented to the exam center without these results, the department then had the rapid antigen test to test the exam, the metric markers and their support staff. And we have since I think this was around in the 4th or 5th of January, we already had 292 examiners positive, I mean markers positive, and these colleagues were then sent home, and the replacements were brought in. So far there are no disruptions in the marking of the exams, and all those that were replacement, they also had to undergo a rapid test to ensure that we minimize the risk of creating a super spreader event at the marking centers. In the next slide, well, we are just highlighting extra additional precautionary measures that we took in terms of the exam, the markers remaining at the centers, and ensuring that there is a minimal interaction with the outside world whilst they are in the process of marking, and also supporting the Department of Education with the cloth masks, sanitizers, and visors and other related supplies. In the next slide, we are talking about the circumcision update, because our province was the only one that had an approval to conduct the initiations during this period, and also a risk adjusted strategy had been submitted. And even though the estimates and the demand seemed higher, the more the communication about the related risks was done and the stringent measures that were done around ensuring the appropriate registration of the schools and the clamping on illegal schools, the fewer initiates were registered for this season, and the screening was done, and 456 of the initiates tested positive, and with the risk adjusted strategy, there were isolation provisions, and there were monitors from Department of Health that were monitoring those that are in isolation, and we must report that we had no incident of a death related to COVID or an admission related to COVID amongst the initiates. What we have so far is 23 admissions for different reasons, ranging from dehydration, septicemia, and surgical complications. And with the deaths, we have had 13 initiates passing and one in maybe. And of the 13, three were unnatural, and as they died from gunshot wounds. And then the next slide, Chair, is just highlighting on the availability of PPE and COVID-19 related medicines, and the department is confident around the availability of both PPE and COVID related medicines. We are going to just then, Chair, provide the highlights on the vaccine rollout in the province. We have looked at the population of the province as provided by the Status A mid-year population estimate, and we estimate that the province will then need to vaccinate approximately 3.7 million people that are above the age of 18. And for the first phase, where we are working mostly at this point, we are estimating that we will have 200,000 healthcare workers and related workers in the province. These will be about 58,000 or 60,000 people that are on PESAL, 58,000 being on PESAL, and others being support staff that come either contracted or doing other work within our health facilities and do interact with our patients. And then in the second phase, it will be approximately 1.5 million people that would be frontline workers in their different categories, people in congregate settings, and the people that are above 60 years of age, and those that are over 18 with comorbidities. And we have done the calculations, and the numbers are quite big for a province like ours. For the third phase, it's about 2 million people that are over 18 that will be vaccinated. We have done some work looking at, in the next slide, we are looking at the prioritization of the distribution of PPE that was organization to try and start to have a semblance of the prioritization process for health workers, starting with those that do aerosol generating procedures of the ward or in the PUI ward, and then the others that that are in contact with patients in other spheres, and those that are not really in contact with patients, like the people that are in the administration side of things and so on. So from our PESAL, we have tried to lift these numbers. Our PESAL at this point is not 100% accurate. We can estimate the numbers of ancillary supplies that we need to have. In the next slide, we have the work that has been done in the province to look at the coordination of this work and the leadership for this work. Whilst we do have the guidance from the national department that the head of department must nominate, appoint members to a coordinating committee, we look at the magnitude and better placed at the office of the Premier for five frontline workers in other government departments, frontline workers in other areas, and see how we work together, whether those the vaccination will happen in those workplaces, in those industries, or the work to collaborate, the monitoring of the doses and so on. So there is a lot of work that we are not certain about at this point, but we found it important that we need to start talking about these things and get a ship level to ensure that we have participation of the different localities to ensure that there is a better preparation. And we looking at our project task teams, we are also looking at moving to district level to ensure that we start planning per district. The Eastern Cape province has a peculiar setting that there are districts that are quite rural, and there are districts that also have that are quite urban, and there are some that have a rural-urban mix, such that you can find a very urban area, and at the periphery, it's a very also rural area. So these require specific plans to be done at each of the districts to look at the issues of storage of the vaccine, to look at the issues of communicating with the different approaches for the different stakeholders that we will be communicating with to ensure that the message comes, highlighting the work that will be done in preparation form. And we are looking at in the next slide, we're looking at the preparations we need to do in terms of looking at security issues, in terms of looking at the resources that must be procured. Once we get the specifications of the resources, we then need to ensure that we have those resources. We build additional capacity for waste disposal and the PPE that will be required as we do the work, and also ensure that we have a tight through a provincial command center to ensure that all the data that is required for storage and also for the vaccines that are distributed and the numbers of people per day that are vaccinated. We have all of that in hand in order to ensure that there is the smooth flow. And also in the next slide, we are showing work that has to be done with the various structures in the province, even at a local level, and also hopefully the electronic vaccine data system that the national department is developing will also be rolled out to the province in time. And in the next slide, we're highlighting that the overall provincial coordination is therefore going to be placed coordinating the implementation the task team with the national department. At this point, these plans are in draft form, and in the next 2 to 3 days, we'll be presenting them to the leadership of the province to ensure that we get further input and further guidance. The two slides that follow, starting with the one that is placed there, is just to show the challenges of the Eastern Cape when we look at the district. We have 24,494 communities, small communities distributed that have to travel more than 5 kilometers to reach a healthcare facility. And of these, the Eastern Cape has 45% of them. And therefore, we do need to work with the Office of the Premier to maybe look at utilization of schools, because the education data system does show that small communities, there is either a primary school or a high school, and we are looking at a guidance of some sort to get from the National Department of Health as to the requirements to ensure safety of the vaccination rollout, so that we can start accrediting spaces in some of these schools to ensure that we have communities that can be able to access the site within a 5 kilometer radius. So at this point, we're trying to calculate how many of these are 5 kilometers from a school as a proxy for access for us. And then we are looking also at COCTA is to see whether we can work also with the disaster management unit as in this work. And we also have found that there are a number of communities that are distributed in this session. So we have 2,873 communities that are in this situation. So the next slide is trying to show the meeting, the situation of these 2,873 communities that have to travel more than 5 kilometers. In OR Tambo, in Amatole District, We have 295 of these communities placed in a municipality. If we look at the right-hand side, that long list that is there is a list of the villages that are in Mbashe that have to travel more than 5 kilometers to a healthcare facility. And if we look there, looking at a population that is above 18, we still have to quantify those populations. So the work that is done in the Eastern Cape, it's slightly different from what the other provinces might be dealing with, because for us, we can see and segment the population of those communities. As it can be seen, we looked at village by village. If we look at the slide, the first is a village with about 34% or so of the people that are there that are above 18, and we're working on the sizes of each and every one of those to see that if we have a mobile to go and vaccinate there, how many resources should be there, and how do we reach there, how do we maintain the cold chain, is there electricity in that area, how is the road infrastructure, and so on. So Chair, I thought I must just highlight these as part of the work that the Eastern Cape is doing for the rollout of the vaccine project. Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Zungu, apparently you have finished, eh? I saw a slide written.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honorable members, Dr. Zungu and Honorable Ngata, my MEC have put themselves in a very big challenge. They've made a presentation for 45 minutes, and they would like to be released after that 45 minutes without a we have to engage Honorable MEC. These members do ask really questions and then they will come back. Let me then give an indication of who are the members who have shown that they want to ask. And I would like them to start in this order. I don't have to come in between. Honorable Emma Sheikh would be number one, followed by Honorable Ismail. The third one would be Honorable Jacobs. Number four, Honorable Sukers. Number five, Honorable Chirwa. Number six, Honorable Kwahube. Number seven, Honorable Kela. Number eight, Honorable Dr. Thembe Kwayo. Number nine, Honorable Chilidzi Munyai. I have not, I skipped this one. Honorable Wilson comes after Dr. Thembe Kwayo, and then Chilidzi, ladies first, you'll be after Honorable Wilson. I have not seen a hand of Honorable Sengwa. I might have missed it. If she would, she must indicate. I didn't see her hand, ma'am. These were the hands that I picked up on the chat group of the Honorable members. Starting again, Imam Sheikh, Ismail, Jacobs, Sukers, Chirwa, Kwahube, Kela, Thembe Kwayo, Wilson, and Chilidzi Munyai. Thank you. In that order, please, Honorable members.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the department for the comprehensive presentation here this morning. Let me start off by asking the first question. There has been repeated reports of the Eastern Cape being a problematic province when it comes to the delivery of services and the ineffectiveness of governance in the Eastern Cape, not only in the health sector, but in various other aspects. Could you tell me from a health perspective, what do you believe is the root causes, and take us into your confidence and tell us, what do you believe that we can do from a national government point of view to help you to overcome these challenges and improve the quality of life in the Eastern Cape? The second thing is I want you to tell me is, What is the percentage of recovery for patients that have been admitted to your hospitals? More importantly, the percentage of recovery from ICU patients that were in ICU and or were also in ventilators. I'd like you to also tell me what is the ratio between the normal deaths that the Eastern Cape province is experiencing currently compared to the COVID-19 deaths. Then the other thing is I want to ask, which is very important, and I think you are aware that in the public domain, there is this issue of a particular drug called ivermectin, which is yielding positive results throughout the world. And for that, I want to read you something. In 1964, the World Medical Association adopted the Helsinki Declaration after careful debate and deliberation in Principle 37 taken from the current revised version. In the treatment of an individual patient where proven interventions do not exist, and it does not exist currently because we've got no guarantee even the vaccines are going to work because it's new, it's 6 months, it hasn't really been tested, or other known interventions have been ineffective, the physician, after seeking expert advice with informed consent from the patient or a legally authorized rep, may use an unproven intervention if in the physician's judgment it offers hope of saving a life. And I don't want to read the whole thing. Now, there's so much of evidence unfolding, and I know to a certain extent provinces have some kind of autonomy. You know the serious crisis in the Eastern Cape. Have you ever, as a department, considered the data yourselves? Forget about SEPRA. Have you considered the data? Have you done any research to see whether, in fact, this might be one of the solutions in the Eastern Cape currently? And then lastly, what are you doing in terms of advising your provincial command council of this particular one district that you say that has not yet been declared a hotspot, but the numbers are rising? Thank you. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to firstly thank the department for the presentation. I just have a few questions which I'll run through quickly. One is, what is the percentage of vacant posts currently in state hospitals in the province? You've given us a breakdown of what's needed, but you haven't given us a real, you know, the real story of the vacant posts, and that's what I would like to know. Secondly is that how many CEO openings are still there and how many CEOs are still acting? Thirdly, you know, we are talking about vaccines, we are talking about what needs to be done, but by now the province should have already got a plan in place for the rollout of these vaccines. You've identified who needs to be given the vaccines first. I'm asking for a comprehensive plan for the rollout of vaccines, broken down to time frames and number of vaccines per day, per district. I think that will tell us exactly where we're going in the province. And I would like to know the planned Oxygen 3 program that was supposed to be starting on the 11th of January, according to your, you know, presentation. Has this started? Also, you know, I think Sheikh Imam has covered the issue of the, you know, the issues in the Eastern Cape that has been going on forever. Can you touch on the infrastructure upgrades that were necessary that has been reported in the media, you know, for so many years? You know, can you touch on the infrastructure updates that has been done? And lastly, the improvement of EMS services, because our communities cannot get efficient services from the hospital if they don't even get to the hospital. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. We appreciate it very much. I want to address my questions based on a number of items. I'm just going to mention them and then I will ask the questions. The beds, the staffing, the testing, the oxygen availability, the ambulances or EMS services, rural and deep rural areas, the private practice, medical and nursing students. We've heard from you that there are three districts which have reached the maximum capacity in terms of beds. And the question I'd like to ask is, would there be a need for you to start new field hospitals, or would there be a need to take some wards and maybe refurbish them to COVID-19 wards? We have seen this epidemic in our country just growing, and it's been growing every province. We have an expectation of a third wave and a fourth wave, and isn't this an opportunity to improve on our facilities and prepare ourselves also for the other waves which are to come? Our number of deaths are a serious challenge, and the number of infected persons and those who are in either high care or in ICU. And that brings us to the point of staffing. Now, we know that we only have a certain number of staff. Some get sick, some are go into isolation, some go into quarantine. We've lost some of our healthcare workers. We appreciate the fact that the Eastern Cape is now taking their community service, nursing practitioners, and their medical doctors, those who complete their community service, into a service in the Eastern Cape, and that would surely alleviate a lot of the challenges, whereas I think previously it was not the case. But we should also look at the, I think they call ward assistants, your community care workers who can be taken up into the system and be able to provide assistance within the wards, and we know there are many different kinds of assistance which can be provided apart from the medical and the nursing work. As far as testing is concerned, I see you are employing the rapid antigen test. Now, there's been a recommendation from the World Health Organization that it be used in particular instances, for example, to identify cases, especially where there's a high positivity rate in a particular area, and to monitor the disease trends. My question is, would this be used for diagnostic purposes, and what are the benefits to be derived from this? And also, I guess it would assist to really be able to work in those rural and deep rural areas, and maybe a different and easier means of getting testing done there. The point of the oxygen is extremely important. I believe that oxygen is the mainstay of treatment there. If we could have had every single patient who arrives at a facility be put on oxygen, we would have saved so many lives. And we have realized that there are many challenges, and those challenges are at the national level and at every provincial level. With regards to the manufacture, the supply, the distribution, the storage, the piping or reticulation system, the type of the manner in which we've been doing that with cylinders and not having oxygen storage, and also not in a liquid form, because of the density that you can get with a liquid form, you can obviously then get four times the amount if you have a regassing unit, which then puts this into a gaseous form. And so it's good to have the bulk storage put up, but we also need to make certain that from the tank it actually gets to the CPAP machine or the intranasal oxygen device, and then to the patient, and then obviously the patient care at the bedside. As far as your the ambulances, there have been challenges that ambulances, you have a patient on high flow oxygen, and now you need to transport that patient, and then the ambulance system is not able to provide the same oxygen flow, and then a huge challenge in order to be able to transport patients to places of higher care. And the question is obviously what have you done in terms of improving that situation? And then also being able to provide facilities where the people live, with all of these things which are mentioned to be in place. As far as rural and deep rural areas, so all of those the points I'm actually raising are very much concerning in our rural and deep rural areas. And we also know that the vehicles which must transport essential goods, and yeah, I'll probably be talking about the testing equipment, but especially oxygen, cannot reach those facilities. And thank you very much that the Eastern Cape has taken upon themselves to transport oxygen with their own vehicles. But we also know there's a challenge with the drivers who must be certified for that purpose. So yes, we have many, many challenges, not only the Eastern Cape, but I think throughout South Africa at the moment with regards to these things. And very lastly, private practice. The private practitioners who should be part of the to see that our medical students and our nursing students also are part of that first phase rollout in every single province. They do play a role, especially from medical students from their third year onwards, and there has been talk of using our final year students and maybe even our first year students in support of the systems towards managing COVID in our country. So I'd like to really place an emphasis on that. Thank you very much. Honourable Zuckers?
Good morning, Chair. I'm not sure if you can hear me. My connection is not very good.
Please go ahead, ma'am, please.
Chair, can you hear me?
We can hear you well. Go ahead.
Okay. I firstly want to say thank you for the presentation by the Eastern Cape province. I have a few questions that I just want to pose, and before I do that, I just want to extend our condolences to the families of the healthcare workers in your province that has lost their lives. My very first question is around the community-based care. We read articles this week where, especially in rural areas, people do not know what to do when people are ill with COVID. And I would like to hear from the province, what plans do you have in place to
Honorable Sukers, we are waiting for you to make your point. In the interest of time, Honorable Chirwa, can you come in, please?
Thank you, Chairperson. My video will be off because I'm also struggling with network. Thank you for the presentation to the Eastern Cape executive. I want to raise a few questions, and the first one is the big concern over infrastructure. Chairperson, what is the plan to counter the issue of infrastructure in the Eastern Cape? We note that in reality, the department has done nothing in regards to this. An example is BG Forrester in Kokama sub-region, which was promised refurbishment by the department for 2 years now to come and fix the roof, create office space for doctors and staff, and expand the waiting area for patients, which is currently a tiny passage, to expand hospital whose capacity was increased from district to regional, and yet you have not increased the actual infrastructure to measure up to this change of district to regional. You've known about the second wave for a while as the province of the Eastern Cape. There is absolutely no excuse on why you have not capacitated three districts with facilities that have high care and ICU facilities. Your incompetence and laziness has resulted in the current high death rate in your province as compared to other provinces. Not only did you waste possible funds for better EMS services, you squandered those funds on meaningless scooters, regardless of the fact that for some patients, ICU is 4 hours away. How do you take responsibility as the province executive, as being an accomplice to avoidable deaths of so many people, as provincial leadership, how do you take responsibility that you have failed in bettering infrastructure and equipping EMS, knowing very well that infrastructure makes that disadvantages those living in rural areas the most? Secondly,
What has been the outcome of the investigation you supposedly sought out for in regards to the use of ivermectin? I'm told that this is medication for animals that was used and prescribed for COVID patients in some health facilities. What is the outcome of the investigation, and what has been done to hold those involved accountable for giving animal medication to human beings without approval from SAPRA in your province? Thirdly, the acting HOD is also currently leading the project management unit, established in April 2020 to manage the COVID-19 and its spread. Can you explain the role of the PMU led by Dr. Zungu? Please explain its impact in terms of the mandate and whether it is progressing towards the right direction in reducing COVID-19 deaths and bettering access to quality healthcare for many of those in rural areas who, as I've said before, are up to 4 hours away from adequate health care. Also, in relation to this, can you also be told why the HOD has not been appointed after the departure, as so to allow Dr. Zungu to focus on PMU duties, which he is failing in right now? Do you really, as a province that is worst performing in the country, think you have 3 months, as per your assertion, in filling these management posts while the vacuum is clearly not being filled? Firstly, we are concerned with the incorrect reporting of COVID-19 deaths in your province. Primary to responding to the crisis relies on data and information. How then should the data we receive from Eastern Cape be noted as truthful and factual when it turns out it has been incorrect and false for the past month through what you term as reconciliation? And in what way has this incompetence on the side of the province affected how you respond to the pandemic? If you are not sure yourselves of the actual impact on a daily basis, more especially because what you term as reconciliation dates back as far as May 2020. And lastly, there was an increase of community healthcare workers and temporary staff at hospitals and clinics, as you have stated. Majority of them, their contracts were meant to elapse in March this year. When will they be given permanent contracts, especially noting that some of your hospitals are only functioning optimally as 24-hour facilities after their temporary employment? When will the province ensure that these community healthcare workers don't go back to being unemployed and will be absorbed permanently by the health facilities you have placed them for or have placed them in relation to responding to the COVID pandemic? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Kwahube.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you to the department for the presentation and to Dr. Zungu. I have a number of questions that I want to get through. The first being, we understand that the Eastern Cape as a province has a systemic failure of healthcare in general, and that has led to the province being one of the weakest links in terms of the response to this pandemic, because ultimately these are historic issues with the province and how it has been run in terms of governance, but also the actual system in terms of vacancy rates, in terms of infrastructure backlog, and all of these things. And so now we find ourselves in a situation where the Eastern Cape was unable to mount a decent response to the pandemic because of these various things. And so what I wanted to understand is we now know that one of the biggest now challenges that is coming up next is the issue of the vaccine rollout. Dr. Zungu did touch on her presentation on what the province is doing to ready themselves in terms of rolling out the vaccine. But I need to understand, if the province is targeting 3.7 million people to vaccinate in the Eastern Cape, many of whom are in rural areas, as Dr. Zungu has said, what is the plan, Dr. Zungu, in very specific words? Because if you've got a problem of rolling out healthcare services as it is, because of the fact that large portions of the province are in rural areas and a large part of the province can't even access a healthcare facility within the next 5 kilometer radius, then what is the actual plan in terms of being able to roll out that vaccine? Because what I foresee here is the province yet again being the weakest link in terms of being able to roll out the vaccine when the time comes. And so I think it becomes even more important that the details around the vaccine rollout for the Eastern Cape are that much more pronounced, particularly now that you are getting reprieve in terms of the stemming of the active infection or the new infection, surely the province should be targeting most of their energy to readying themselves to vaccinating almost 4 million people. Can I please get some more clarity on the specifics relating to this? Then I want to also just get clarity, Dr. Zungu, because you mentioned the prioritization of healthcare workers, which is obviously quite important. How is the department going to also be reaching the healthcare workers in the private sector? We know that particularly in areas such as NMB and Buffalo City Municipality, the private hospitals in those areas have been completely snowed under. That then means that there's obviously a huge need to vaccinate and reach those healthcare workers as well. Can we get some clarity on how the strategy of reaching those healthcare workers would look like? Then you didn't explain. You just mentioned repeatedly the issue around Jokabi and how that district in particular is seeing an increase in new cases, but there was no theory. I'm sure the department has worked out exactly why it is that district is experiencing those numbers. Can you perhaps clarify what is going on? Why is it that you're seeing a trend in the rest of the province and then you're seeing a very different trend there? Are there circumstances that are meaning that this particular district is suffering in that way? And if so, what is that issue? Then, Dr. Zungu, the other issue is that we've seen the Eastern Cape has had massive fatalities, a lot more than many other provinces. I mean, if we look at just a 10-day average alone, and we look at just the past 2 weeks, and we calculate and tally, I think you did give a figure in your presentation. I don't have the number now offhand, but if we tally and we look at the death rate of the Eastern Cape, the fatalities are much, much higher than in many other parts, including the Western Cape, of course, but they're in many other parts of the country. Why is that? Why is it that the fatalities are much higher than the actual just like new infections? So the ratio between the new infections and the fatalities is just much more pronounced. Is it because of the system failure in the province? Is it because the health system is so broken that it's unable to absorb people who do get infected by essentially being able to assist them? Is it because a lot more people are dying at home? Which brings me to the next point. Why has the province only started doing posthumous tests only now? Because that has now skewed the numbers that you have said that you are presenting, you have been presenting to the country. Because as far as I understand, I mean, when we had the huge numbers that were released about 2 weeks ago from the province, we saw that the numbers were actually said to have been a backlog. What is going on with the numbers there? The premier of your province had said that they are looking into that and investigating. What is the status of that investigation? Are these numbers, can they be trusted? Are they authentic or are they being doctored? And then the last thing is around the initiation. In your presentation, you mentioned that there were 1,755 illegal initiations. If you can just explain what that is, what illegal initiations are. Thank you very much.
Honorable Tela, thank you very much, Chair. Let me first welcome the presentation and also send my deepest condolences to our health workers who lost their life. Chairperson, first I must appreciate the good work that the Department of Health in Eastern Cape is doing. Because we can see that they are trying all the levels best to make sure that they save lives of our people in that province. Although there are a lot of challenges, but I think if we work together, we can make sure that we address all those challenges, because it's not only their responsibility, but also as the national department, pertinent, we must make sure that we intervene. But also appreciate the Minister, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, for doing oversight, and also the WHO representative that came, joined Dr. Mkhize in Eastern Cape, and also to thank all the donors who have donated in the Eastern Cape to make sure that it's a concern to all people of South Africa that we save that province. As we know that that province is a rural province actually, and we must focus there and to make sure that we save the people's lives there. But also to check and also to appreciate the security guards in that area. We have saw it in the media that an Eastern Cape health worker was arrested at Frete Hospital in Komani on Saturday for alleged stealing of PPE, which we really appreciate the work that the security guard has done, because PPE is something that is also protecting them to make sure that they are not getting infected for COVID-19. And also we appreciate from the presentation that the department has stocked enough PPE for Eastern Cape, so that at least they have enough PPE for their health workers. Chairperson, my question number one is that what are your alternatives for oxygen suppliers in the Eastern Cape? Second one is that we note the increase in the admissions, increase, and how do you plan to manage this? The third one, Chairperson, is when do you expect to have a full and comprehensive rollout plan in the province? That will be my question, Chair. And then maybe if Dr. Zung can also just touch on the issue that we also saw on the media, the issue of people who were complaining about their loved ones, those who have lost their families that are being wrapped with three plastics, and now when they are coming home, they are those being traditional issues which they are saying they are not satisfied. So if maybe she can also touch on that one, but also to appreciate, because it seems as if now the Eastern Cape people, they realize that COVID is there, it's really, and it's killing. And we have saw some articles, the young people, they were trying to communicate through pamphlets to educate our elderly, but also to make sure that they spread the message that people, they must wear masks, they must make sure that they sanitize, they wash hands, and they must be safe, which is something that we really communicate, because we understand in far rural areas sometimes the communication is not there, but at least they are trying. And also I want to appreciate that you are also trying to reach the far, far, far rural area, as we understand how Eastern Cape is. For instance, in the area where it's like Pomam Fletcher, so we know that there are deep rural area in that area, but the department has managed to reach those areas, which is a good thing. And we really appreciate, and we are praying that God, if can save South Africa, because it's not on our making, this issue of COVID-19. We need to come together and work together, and also ask God that, God, can you please save South Africa, because really this thing is killing. And I know, because I was also having COVID, and I know how painful it is, and I know the stress that the department has, and also our front work health workers that are facing daily. So the only thing that we must do as politicians, all parties, we must come together and make sure that we bring some assist our health workers, so that, and also we assist our departments, all officials, to make sure that we overcome this thing, because really it's not on our own making, this thing of COVID-19, but also make sure that we stand together, we join hands, we pray, and also we work together. So if we are speaking with one voice, to make sure that God must forgive our sins and make sure that He heal His nation. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Dr.
Tempwayo. Thank you, Chairperson. Dr. Zungu, in your presentation, I didn't hear you mentioning and appreciating the contributions of the 900 oxygen machines that the Eastern Cape received from the gift of givers. The machines that were developed by CSIR and approved by SAPRA and also were fully funded. Can you explain to us how these oxygen machines supplied to you helped the province? During the first lockdown, chronic patients were unable to access medication. Explain the measures taken to ensure that all chronic patients have access to medication. A mention was made of 9,000 health workers that were tested positive, inclusive of 101 the ones that died. I just would like to know that, because there is a considerable number of health personnel that have complained about fatigue, and this fatigue is also in correlation with the numbers that you have given here. What has your department done about this? And have you provided any psychological help to this? And on the same note, I would like to correlate the question to the information that you provided to us, to say in the marking centers in the Eastern Cape, you identified some workers that were markers that were positive identified of COVID-19. On the same note, I just would like to know, what are the psychological support measures that are in place to be given to those markers? If not, why? Please explain to us the allegation of mixing patients of other hospitals with those from Empilweni TB Hospital. And further, I would also like to reiterate to say your province does not have a clear, finest details of your rollout plan of the vaccines. Because throughout your presentation, you also used words like, we will see how we will work with the others, because there's a lot of work that needs to be done. We don't expect such alterations now. What you are supposed to say must be in line with the National Department of Health, who came here and declared the readiness of rolling out the vaccines. I mean, if the national is ready, what about your province, which is not ready, which does not even have a task team to engage on this matter? What about the district? What about the communities who are identified as those that are supposed to receive the vaccine? We need a detailed, the finest detailed plan of the rollout of your vaccine, unfortunately. Excess death is viewed as serious concern, especially in your province. What is being done to ensure that every death is documented properly? Because I think that is not done. We are only concentrated on COVID-19 deaths. The following question: how many Cuban doctors are deployed in your province? In which facilities are they deployed? Thank you. Chairperson.
Yes, Honorable Wilson, please note, honorable members, that you do have a limitation in terms of time with this department, that is Eastern Cape.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, thank you for the presentation. It's quite extensive, however, there are two areas that were not discussed at all. The first one is the collapse of the EMS system. Now, we know that in the Eastern Cape, an ambulance, one provincial ambulance, is often required to cover an area up to 20,000 kilometers, such as the shortage of EMS services in the Eastern Cape. Now, in the middle of a pandemic, this is obviously a huge crisis. We have information of ambulances queuing up at hospitals, waiting for patients to be triaged, screened, admitted, sometimes sitting outside hospital for 2 to 3 hours, if not longer. This creates a huge backlog in the system because as long as ambulances are queuing up at hospitals, they are unable to service other emergencies. And as it is, they have huge areas to cover. Can you please tell us what you are doing to upgrade to EMS service and get rid of this backlog? The other situation that wasn't discussed yet, that is obviously a huge area of concern, is your mortuaries. We are hearing constant reports of refrigerated trucks being moved into mortuaries to store bodies because either there's a backlog on autopsies or that mortuaries just aren't in no way equipped to deal with the amount of deaths taking place in the Eastern Cape. And we know that yours are particularly high and that your, as far as this is concerned, it is a very real crisis. So please can you tell us what the situation is with the mortuaries and what is being done to stop the backlog in that area. And I have a huge, huge concern about the exhumation of bodies because people are not happy that they're wrapped in plastic. And there are cultural procedures that they would like to see take place. Number one, there is legal boundaries around the exhumation of bodies, and these generally have to be applied for via a legal process, so it would appear that that is not happening. Number two, there is exhuming bodies that are open, which immediately puts all of those people around those bodies at risk, and this is a severe crisis. Can you please tell us what you are doing to actually address this crisis? We understand traditional protocols and things that need to be done, but we cannot do this without following legal process, and we certainly cannot do it. Lives are being put at risk. Thank you.
Honorable Senwa. Mama Senwa. Okay, let's move to Honorable Chilidzi Munyai. Honorable Munyai.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, for the opportunity. I think first and foremost, I would want to welcome the report, comprehensive, detailed report from the acting MEC from Eastern Cape, which really give us a sense on the state of affairs in that province and the progress that they've made, and in indication really outline that the situation is getting better, the sense of decline in terms of the negative impact of COVID in that area, especially indicated in the two critical areas, which were the drivers, such as Nelson Mandela Bay, and I think I just listed the other province. But what I want to get, Honorable Chairperson, will the Eastern Cape department or MEC require additional support from the Ministry of Health, or because so far as I could analyze, they are making a very great progress. And I think what's critical, Honorable Chairperson, is continuous guarantee for oxygen availability and a continuously a guarantee for all critical support. And I think also the critical focus, you know, of you should be much focused on the testing of much more people that are not really passed on. But that will be very much advisable from my point of view. After that, Honorable Chairperson, I don't think I will have any other critical question. Safe to say that we need to really congratulate them for the great progress they are making. It was worse in Eastern Cape at some point. We are nearly losing hope. But after receiving this this report, we can sleep at night. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. May I check if Honorable Sukers is able to ask her question now, also followed by Honorable Shengwa. I will pause for 30 seconds. If they are able to, let them come in. If they are not, I've asked them to send their questions in another platform.
Chair, I'm on, but I will keep my video off, Chair, if I may.
Please do.
Okay. Once again, thank you for the presentation. My questions are the following. You did extensive planning at the beginning of the pandemic. We received reports that implementation was very delayed. I will take an example, oxygen provision. What was planned for in April and May, and how long did it take to deliver on those plans? And what was the cause for the delays? What assurances can you give this committee and the people of the Eastern Cape that you will be ready for a third and a fourth wave? Earlier I spoke of an article, and I will read you the quotes from a resident in the Eastern Cape. She said the following. She said, "We don't know what is right and wrong. We have been losing our parents, brothers and sisters." And then she goes on to say that she lost 6 family members to COVID-19. Now, could you please tell us what plans do you have for an urgent and comprehensive communication campaign that will ensure communities are informed about COVID, that's one, and secondly, what the symptoms are and what they need to do to ensure early treatment, because early treatment would, of course, mean that there would be fewer critical cases arriving in casualty. Could you also give us an indication what plans do you have to, in terms of that communication plan, give people guidelines around how to take care of the ill at home, those that are moderately ill? It is information that communities need, especially communities where care or family is prioritized, such as the Eastern Cape. Could you also give us an indication of plans, if you have any, for home-based care for the moderately ill, especially in rural areas? Then, thirdly, it is becoming clear that people are suffering psychological trauma due to multiple deaths in families. Could you provide us with indications on how the province will attend to the increased need for counseling, especially supportive care for healthcare workers and those who suffered multiple losses due to COVID? Thank you, Chair.
Is Mamushengwa back, able to ask her questions? Okay, if not, let me then pose only two. One, I do not have a big fight with regards to the doing tests on bodies over and above doing it on live people. But one just wants to check the rationale behind that. And number two, whether it does not take your space and time to deal with the long queues of those who are waiting to be done the COVID-19 test. But number two, related to what Dr. Tembekwayo asked, what is the value add? I know you probably may not be able to. That if we do not have the Cuban specialist just in your province, forget about other provinces, we may pose this question to them. What is the value add of the Cuban specialists that have come in just around the issue of a pandemic? Just to thank you, and then the last one, Dr. Zungu, same as Honorable Chirwa, your role in that province is commendable, whether you are an acting HOD or a PMU leader. Are you able to define where is your maximum area of impact there, and how quickly are they going to be able to maybe fill in the post of the HOD? Thank you very much. But honourable members, so that we do not take too much time from the Western Cape presentation, we may not go beyond 11 o'clock with the responses, and there will be no follow-up because Western Cape is going to be logging in any time now, and we need to also be able to listen to them and engage with them. So responses, Dr. Zungu, and I know you have to be in ESCO now, but we still need to hear your responses to all the members' questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I will try and answer the questions. Some of them might not have the responses now, and I would request that we maybe return them in a written form. Firstly, Chair, I'll go for the questions that were brought around the issues of the province and its challenges. And I must indicate that the challenges in the province have been there for many, many, many years. And its challenges that relate to the rural nature of the province and the infrastructure backlogs that are there, and also the dwindling budgets in the health sector in general that affect those provinces that are not starting from the zero line. The Eastern Cape province starts from a minus point and has to catch up to arrive at the zero point where everybody else is starting. And in terms of then moving from that point, then it lags behind in moving, because there are challenges that relate to access to services, be it water, be it electricity, that are related to the topography of the province, that are related to the issues. If I may put an example, just now and almost every season, it seems like the Eastern Cape gets hit by a disaster. Before we closed last year, before we ended the year, we had already had two disasters, and we have had another disaster. And this hits facilities that are already there and hits communities and sets the province back again on the work that had already been done. In terms of the percentages for recovery from ICU and from ventilators, that information is available, but at this point I was not able to raise it. But we do have that information, and in general, if I may just respond in the general terms, we have found that quite a high number of patients that are put on ventilator have a poor health outcome, the same as with those that are in ICU. And it becomes worse when the patients have one or more comorbidities, and also the outcomes become worse with age of the patient that is in ICU or on the ventilator. So we have that that matter. And on the issue of ivermectin, and I can indicate that we are following the guidance from the Ministerial Advisory Committee, as well as the guidance that has been issued by the SAPRA. And to this point, that is how we are operating in the province. We have looked at Joe Kabi District as the only district that is not a hotspot, but having a rising number of cases. What we have observed from the data that we have is that Joe Kabi District was the last to come out of the first wave, and again, it is the last to enter the second wave. As we can see the trends in that particular district, we have then realized that it is starting the second wave when others are almost approaching the peak or coming out of the peak of the second wave. In terms of the vaccine rollout plans, we have done the plans at provincial level. We have appointed the task team there. And as indicated, we have guided the districts on how they can structure their teams. But once we are doing that, we are also working on quantifying the numbers of people that have to be vaccinated. And I must indicate that, as Honorable Jacobs asked, we said we have 60,000 in the public sector, 58,000 of which are on our PESAL system, and 200,000 is earmarked for phase one. In that 200,000, in that number, we are putting private sector and the public sector and health sciences students that are about to interact with patients. And we are also putting the health workers that are in the NGOs, those that are working in the campus clinics around the province, and also the clinics in the industry. And where we have gaps, where we are not certain yet, is whether the work will be done at the private sector site by the private sector providers, or it will be the Department of Health working with the private sector, and so on. So we are still looking into those particular details guided by the National Department of Health. Also, in our province, we looked at the work that we have to do in identifying for phase two the frontline workers in the different departments, and we thought the plan would be better placed if the overall coordination is at the Office of the Premier, where, again, we are just awaiting the announcement of the team that is working with the Office of the Premier. Otherwise, we are, all that has been done with the consultation and the presentations that have been done at the extended PCC, at PCC, and to the executive of the province, as well as to the body of HOPs in the province. In terms of the update on infrastructure, we did not come with the report, but the report exists, and what I can indicate that the work that the province did to improve the infrastructure yielded over 3,000 beds that made the province to be able to address the issues related to COVID-19. And in terms of also of the emergency services, there has been an injection of additional vehicles as well as staff to the emergency services just before the festive season started. And in terms of the rapid antigen test, as indicated from the 17th of November, the province started utilizing the rapid antigen test, and it has become a blessing mainly in the districts that are remote, like the Alfred Nzo district, and some of the other districts also where we are experiencing a high number of cases. This includes the Joe Kabi district and the Kristani and Amatole and the others in the urban settings. In terms of the vaccine rollout, we do have a the detailed plan, and the detail is so much that we are looking at the spread of the population in the province. If we start from the west, looking at Sarah Batman district, there is the sparse settlement pattern in Sarah Batman, and therefore the modalities for a vaccination, even for phase one, for the health workers, we would require to use more of an outreach mode. However, we are also looking at keeping the cold chain and looking at the issues of vaccine storage. We are exploring also working with the private sector in that regard, looking at how we can deal with the last mile deliveries of the vaccine to ensure that we maintain the cold chain. In terms of the initiations, the illegal initiation schools, that's what we were referring to, and those initiates that we outlined were done at the illegal initiation schools. And the monitoring was so close that those schools were closed down immediately after they were discovered. In terms of oxygen alternatives, the province is looking at already we have done this work. The province has distributed oxygen concentrators to facilities that are more remote. And at the same time, we have increased the numbers in other areas. We have even tripled the number of cylinders that we are giving to each facility. As we roll out the oxygen tanks in the facilities, we are moving the cylinders to the facilities that are more remote and ensuring that the supplies are improved in those areas. This is why when AFROX was having a challenge, we then used our own trucks to deliver the cylinders to this, to take them from the AFROX site and deliver to the other areas. And the issue of the digging of graves, it is quite unfortunate. However, we all have to understand each other and our belief systems, and it becomes important to look at each other and respect each other's belief systems. I'm glad that the honourable member did indicate that there are legal provisions for the digging of graves, and if we are to ensure that we create a bridge for our communities within the very legal framework, we need to be able to make it possible that to fulfil the issues that relate to their needs, psychological and spiritual. If they need to perform those rituals for their own needs and fulfillment as a people, then we have to look for it within the legal framework and consider all the needs of others in terms of the legislation that we put forward. So it will be important that we create a bridge to get into the realities of our people and ensure that those realities are realized through progressive work to ensure that we provide within the safe environment for our individuals in different settings. In the next matter was about our health workers. We do have challenges in the whole province. We have lost staff members, and we have a psychosocial support stream that comprises of Department of Health, Department of Social Development, and working with the civil society and the religious sector. We do have sessions that have increased. We have even had some of the traditional leaders coming up and requesting bereavement support for some of the families that have had more than one member departing, and also in situations where there have been funerals many times within one village. So we do have also prayer sessions that do take place. I'm aware that in this week or next week there is going to be a prayer session that will be run concurrently in all the community radio stations in the province, where there will be an attempt to deal with that situation. We do also have, as a province, a wellness manager who is assisting the staff with support. We also have our medical school at Walter Sisulu working with all the three major regions of the province, where we have psychosocial support initiatives led by Professor Zingela and the teams that are distributed in the province, either for psychosocial support on the online or physically in the workplaces. The province does also have extended the psychosocial support services that were provided by one service provider for emergency services and for forensic services. That support is now rolled out to all the health workers in the province. Over and above, there is work that is being done where managers are also trained with the work that is done in support, supported by an external provider that that we have had through donor funding, where we are having support to the staff through their own supervisors, where the supervisors have been trained to ensure that there is support. On the issues that relate to the mixing of TB patients at Mbilweni Hospital, actually that particular hospital has been re-designated during the peak of COVID-19 in the Nelson Mandela Bay District. That facility was redesignated as a facility for PUIs, and then patients would be tested from there and redistributed to other areas that were designated for isolation and management of confirmed patients. On the issues relating to excess deaths and the statistics, we have engaged with the NICD and the WHO and our own epidemiologists in the province to look at the numbers of deaths. It is not that the statistics is inaccurate. However, the systems kicked in a delayed fashion in terms of a system to record the deaths. And as such, we are now back capturing, and as we get to the numbers, we report them. We are not hiding the numbers. We put them forward as according to months. It would then be seen that actually the deaths in the province coincide with the curve of the epidemic in the province. In terms of the numbers of Cuban doctors that are deployed in the province, Chairperson, I won't mention each hospital, but we have 35 Cuban professionals that are deployed in the province, and at the time when Nelson Mandela Bay Metro was having the highest number of new cases and the highest number of admissions in the province, most districts actually took their Cuban brigade to the field hospital in Nelson Mandela Bay Metro, and they became the pillars of the response in that facility at that time, and they have since been redistributed with a few still remaining at the field hospital. Lastly, Chairperson, if I may just talk about the issues of ambulances parked at the outside the facilities. Whilst this is an unfortunate incident, it was not experienced in the public sector facilities, but we have opened up where patients are willing to be admitted in public sector facilities, especially in Buffalo City Metro. We do have spaces, and we have accepted patients on medical aid or private sector patients there if the patient is willing to be admitted at our facility. Thank you, Chair. I will stop there for now. Thank you.
Honourable members, I do note that we brought this department, this province, to deal with issues of COVID and vaccines, but we at liberty to ask as many issues that we like to ask, issues about ambulance, the infrastructure, the challenges about the human resource, and all the other issues. I was going to request that if there has not been sufficient responses to some of our questions, we then request a follow-up, and just note there was and send it to our secretary, who will then be able to communicate, because yes, we don't meet the provinces as detailed and spend just all the time with them now. But with the limited time that we have, I think they have been a fair share of our understanding of what they are actually trying to do, not only on COVID, not only on vaccines, but generally on other issues. And thank you, Honorable Mata, our acting MEC, and thanks to Dr. Zung and the team. I would like to just check now if we can release them and then start in the next. I see Dr. Noma French Bombo is already logged in. Let us then release the Eastern Cape. And thank you very much for understanding that even though you had ESCO, we needed you to be in this meeting. And then we then release you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members. Goodbye.
Come the province of the Western Cape. I noticed Dr. Noma French Bombo, our MEC in that province, and the season leader on health issues, who has already logged in. We welcome Dr. Bombo, and would like to now give this platform to yourself to introduce your team and therefore take us through what you have presented to us. As we're just wrapping up with the Eastern Cape, you'll notice that these honorable members are at liberty to ask you anything, whether you have a nebulizer in a particular clinic or you do have this, that, and the other. So please be ready for questions. But as we are saying, if we go beyond 12:30, we'll just be going on an injury time. We'll see how much we can take beyond 12:30. But let me then, without taking too much time, welcome Dr. Bombo and your delegation. Introduce them and then you start your presentation. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair, and the honorable members, and also the officials that are here. Thank you for inviting the Western Cape to be part of having to account to the National Assembly. With me, I've got Dr. Keith Kitter, who's the HOD, and I think there might be one person from my office. Because of the time, Chair, I'll do a short preamble, and then Dr. KC can be able to do the presentation so that he provides much time for the member to be able to ask questions, as you indicated, Chair, that whatever for the burning issue, you can't only focus only on what is being presented. In the first wave, Chair, if you recall that we had, when we did the planning, we had what we call the first, the worst scenarios or the better scenarios, something like that, in response to the COVID. Actually, when we put all some of these measures in place, where we sharpened the axe in terms of the worst scenarios, which we ended up not having it for the whole of South Africa, actually prepared us now for the second wave. So we find that there are some of many other interventions that we planned at the time, but we ended up actually implementing them. But now we find that that is more of assistance, but also we have to beef up and strengthen them more. Also, Chair, because we were the first one to have this epidemic pandemic in the Western Cape, we were once dubbed as the Cape Wuhan. It actually made us to be like a lab where we could be able, because we know that the virus keeps on changing itself. It mirrors differently from each and every population. So hence we start to transplant some of what has been happening internationally. So it made us to keep on trying many other things with the various stakeholders, be it the clinicians, be it the private and all of those. Same applies with some of the interventions, for example, the water testing by the municipalities just to check the presence of the virus. The serology, which is the blood testing, which our researchers do work closely with the university, where we were able to test the presence of the antibodies, like in the Kylie and all of those during the time. And also that even the team from the KZN and others through the CRIST, they managed actually to, we were part of the of the settings where they tested also the presence of the variant. So having said this, Chair, it made us actually to be ahead of the pack because we have been able to keep on testing what other stuff we could be able to do. Same applies with the intelligence system. That's our technology and also our reporting, the daily data in terms of the collecting the intelligence, and also that we could be able to, the access test that we receive from the MRC or from the Vital Registration, from the Home Affairs, we could be able actually to see whether they are COVID or not, although the death would have been happened outside the health system that is at home, up to the level that we even tested even the death for COVID, or even conducting some of the, a little bit of taking, because I don't want to say that the post-mortem, because we can't do post-mortem for COVID, some tissues for those people who might have died unknowingly at the hospital. Chair, we also learned some other lessons in terms of working in partnerships. Because I made an example of a public-private health, with a private health where when we determine our number of beds, especially for the critical care bed space, we did realize that we'll have a shortfall of the critical care beds, which is not unusual, actually, even internationally. So it's not only about the beds, but it's also about the staff, and we do know that how long or resources we need to train ICU medics or nurses in that regard. So we were able to be part of the guinea pigs, even when the national minister indicated or confirmed the tariffs for the public-private. So we already determined in terms of what is it in for us in regard to developing similar, same protocols. Because we can't send patients to the private and then they treat them differently from the ones in the public, yet they are all public patients. So we have been able to learn about all of those. And also partnership with the organized labor in regard to the occupational health and safety, because you need your staff, because staff comes first, but that we have been able even to have these the unions as part of the provincial higher-level decision-making, which is, it helps us now that we are planning in terms of the rollout of the vaccines. And also, Chair, working with the local government, you'll be surprised that within the district, it's the mayors actually who report on COVID response, inclusive of the health response and all others, because it is the role of society and role of government when they report to the provincial command council around that. Even with the national space, because we are the ones actually submitted for the tighter call for the tighter restriction now in the end of December because of the issue of the impact of trauma on our ECs based on the evidence we collected, especially around the alcohol. The resilience of the staff and teamwork were actually dismantled the whole of the hierarchy, which is normally happening in the space of government, and where we also strengthen the principle of subsidiarity so that the team could be able to work where they are to decentralize this. That's why we find that one hospital might say, oh, actually I find an old building, a boiler room in this hospital premises where we can convert it to the field hospital bed. Oh, actually our record room on the ground floor, we can convert to the field hospital bed. So it is crucial in terms of the decentralization. And actually, Chair, lessons learned, because the HOG is going to talk about the challenges. The lessons learned is about also going towards the universal health coverage that requires not only the accessibility of quality care, but also the power of the partnership going forward, as we have already indicated. And also lastly, Chair, the flexibility in regards to what we do. So sometimes we hear this is the testing strategy, and then it's a down month later, we'll find that the differential strategy, one of the lessons learned is about one size doesn't fit all. You must have the flexibility in regard to that space. Like no one would have thought that you can work with the taxi industry in regard to transferring inter-facility transfer of the patients, or patients who are need to go to the quarantine isolation where the taxi industry has managed to, what we call the red dot, refurbish their taxis so that they could be able to pick up these patients from home and take them to the quarantine. And lastly, Chair, as I indicated earlier, you will never be able to strengthen the system without the healthcare workers, which is our priority. Whilst we have seen currently about more than, I think, 1,000 plus active cases of the healthcare workers, and I think about 101 since March 2020 in terms of those who passed on. This is one of the issues where you find that the psychological impact, irrespective if you can appoint as many, because we've been appointing many on the contract as well, but that psychological impact, when you have a colleague who you hear that who has been working together in this ward and you hear that he's fighting for his or her life or his passed on, it does have a huge impact among the team. So it's not only about the absence of those people, especially when they are on isolation, but it is that psychological impact, which is the HOD will do the presentation to show you how we ensure that we bring that psychological support, also working with the Metropolitan and others, so that we bring it to them at a local level. And now we're going through the phase of the death and dying, so that we could be able to provide that support to our healthcare workers, because they've been through a lot. And the reason why we asked the presidency through the National Minister of Health, which is that we need to have a breather just for 2 weeks to protect our healthcare workers, to save our health, especially if now there's going to be a festive season and then we have got all of these trauma units in the EC that will be fully packed. We cannot deal with this. Plus also with the COVID, taking note that we also have the mental health patients that will find that they will come, especially during this time when people are trying to grapple with the issues of the economy and having no food to eat. So, Chair, HOD is going to do the presentation and then I will take the questions and later on. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Chairperson?
Yes, no, the HOD can then move on. Thank you very much for those opening remarks. Thank you.
Chairperson, can I just check exactly how many minutes you would want me to spend on the presentation to make sure that there's enough time for questions?
I have you seen your slides? Anything that will take you to, now is about 11, or 5 past 11. If you could go, we would have to close this meeting 12:30. So you do allow 30 minutes questions and maybe 30 minutes response from members. Yeah.
Thank you for that guidance, Chairperson. Good morning to everyone, all the members. I'm going to share my slides. As you said, the slides have been shared with all of you. Chairperson, is that clear to everyone?
Quite clear on my side. Thank you.
Thank you. So my presentation will touch on really just our approach, and we have coined what we call a 5-point COVID resurgence strategy. I will then touch on each of those points: community prevention, surveillance and response, scaling up of our health platform capacity, the fatalities management, and the vaccine management. So what I'm going to start off with is the 5-point strategy. So it's really just about our learning from the first time when we put our strategy together for the containment for the second wave. It was really about changing community behavior to prevent infection, number one. The second one is a very clear surveillance and an outbreak response strategy. The third one is our ability of our healthcare platform to scale up capacity to deal with COVID disease. The fourth one is to maintain an essential small part of comprehensive services while scaling down everything else to accommodate COVID. And the last one, which Minister Mbombo was talking about, it is really about safeguarding and protecting the well-being of healthcare workers. So if I can start with community prevention, currently the situation is as follows, and it should be very familiar to this committee. The adjusted level 3 measures and restrictions and regulations remains in place. All the Western Cape districts currently are hotspots. The movement of people, the curfew is now from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock the next morning. All establishments closing at 8 o'clock. The mandatory mask wearing and the restrictions on gathering and public transport, and then the total prohibition of alcohol off-site, on-site, and public consumption. In our province, as a health sector, we work very closely with law enforcement. We have a system where we have a provincial, a city, and each district municipality have what we call disaster management centers. The multi-sectoral response has been and continues to be coordinated via these disaster management centers with joint operation centers in all of them. So we do a systematic enforcement of regulations along with SAPS via all these structures. And multiple joint operations have occurred between the law enforcement agencies across a range of high-risk settings over the last 2 or 3 months, obviously heightened by the new regulations over the last 2 to 3 weeks. Then another big thrust of our campaign is central messaging. That's on the risk of transmission, especially around indoor gatherings. And then the decentralized, which is like neighborhood communication. And then very sector-specific targeted messaging has continued while we do that. So what I'm going to share with you is now the health response, making the assumption that all of those things has been done multi-sectorally via those coordinating structures. So the first health response is really around surveillance and response. And our outbreak surveillance process and outbreak response from the outset was premised on getting this. What we set ourselves to is to get a world-class intelligence system. So it's really about setting up a data system to be able to track where infections happen and to respond. The second one is what we call comprehensive case and contact tracing. The third one is management of local outbreaks when these does occur. And then the last one is to be able to activate a multi-sectoral containment response, which includes isolation and quarantine and all the aspects about containment. So the intelligence system, in our province we have something called a provincial health data center. This pre-existed COVID, and we could leverage of having this data center. So what it is, it's an electronic data center that imports data from multiple places and then puts them together and then produce intelligence for you. The second thing is, out of that data center, we can then draw reports, and I will show you some of the reports that we draw on a daily basis to be able to say, what is our case reports, what is our hospitalization report, what is our death reports, health worker reports, warden and mapping of where cases are, operation bed reports, admission lists, and then individual case summaries. These are all the things that we can draw out of our system. The third thing is a dashboard. It's a public-facing dashboard. This dashboard has now taken over more than 1.5 million hits already, and it's really updated every day, and the public can go in and see what's happening with cases in our area. It also has surveillance reports, lab analysis, comorbidity reports, and hotspot identification built into this dashboard. Then we have additional data. So what we do is we draw from the Medical Research Council data. They do the weekly excess death data, and we import that data into our system so that we can cross-align our reported deaths with the data that comes from Home Affairs and from people's ID numbers in terms of death certificates. Then also the wastewater surveillance system is a very innovative system. It's where we are actually, via the municipalities, they're tracking the levels of COVID in wastewater monitoring. We also have local huddles where the teams meet, and we import that local intelligence in the databases. Then we also have the modeling, and that is about modeling what is expected, what's going to happen to the waves, and all of those. And then a special report that we've also drawn from this, it's an under 20 report, to just track what is the picture with cases of children and people under the age of 20. And it was quite useful information that came out of that under one of our outbreaks amongst young people. And then the intelligence is we draw all of that together so that we can actually inform the data to help the management of cases. So case and contact tracing, We have district managers and what we call pods. We have a call center. We have some advice. And then we have surveillance, and we do all of this for all the cases that is responded, and it's decentralized in all of the units in the province. This is then what comes out of the system. So this is a daily report that we update once a day, and it's now on the dashboard. And this is just at a snapshot. You can see this is up until yesterday. This is what the situation of the overall situation is in the Western Cape. You can see on the left-hand side the first wave, and on the right-hand side, the bars represent the second wave. I'll explain to you quickly what the lines mean. The bottom line, which is the yellow line, is the test positive. That's the number of specimens we sent to the laboratory and what proportion of them are coming back as positive. It's quite a sensitive indicator. If that starts dropping, that you know that you're moving into a peak and starting to come out of the peak. The second one is the dotted red line. That is our officially reported deaths. And then the solid red line is the deaths by date, and this is where we cross-pollinate our deaths also with what comes from Home Affairs via the MRC. The blue line is the one I'm going to come back to quite extensively now. The blue line is the patients that find themselves in hospital. That's public and private hospitals. And then the green line is something that we learned in the first wave, is the daily oxygen use. If you put all of those together, it's quite sensitive, the markers that you can put together in terms of cases, hospitalization, daily oxygen use, deaths, and then the test positivity. So we track this in real time on a day-to-day basis to see where we are. This is just the one that I draw out. It's the mortality, and that is the death data. You can also then see in the first wave how we've done it, and then to the second wave. And you can see then the overlay of all the things that we import. So you can see what is reported by us on the same day, what is reported by us on the next day, what are the reported cases that where there was a delay in the reporting to us of 2 to 3 days, of 4 to 6 days, of 7 to 13 days, and then sometimes even as long as 14 days delays. You can see a lot of that happens at the peak when hospitals are very busy. But then we see also a grey line where we project, based on our historical reporting delays, we then project the numbers, and then the delays make up with it. So we also now have a pattern of saying, if we take into consideration that some of the results are delayed, we can project what the death is at any given time. And then the excess death, the green one, is what comes from the MRC. So you can see then in the first wave, where the excess death, the dotted line, is in relation to that. And now in the second wave, you can see how closely we are aligned to the MRC with the excess death, because our systems are in place. And then the two lines that I showed in the first graph, the ones officially reported.
from all the deaths, and not like many people think, is that younger people are dying. Younger people are dying because we have more cases, but proportionately, it's not out of keep with what was happening. The more important one, the reason why we looked at all of this, is to say that the comorbidity profile changes. The diabetes is very much the same like the first wave. It's still the leading big risk factor other than age. So you can also see age. Anybody over the age of 70, there's a big risk. And if you go to comorbidity, diabetes is the single biggest risk. Hypertension, quite interestingly, is also featuring quite high in the death this time around. That's very comparable to the first part of the first wave. And because you see we are on an upswing in the second wave, we expect that if it starts going again down into a trough, that similar patterns will come up. But chronic kidney disease, COPD and asthma, previous TB, current TB, and HIV actually is less of a factor now than it was in the first wave. So there's a note there that maybe the areas that were worst hit in the first wave in our areas had higher HIV prevalence. That would explain why the proportion of people that's HIV positive for the death is lower now than it was the first time around. This is our active cases. So just to give you the picture that you saw about the reproductive number, we can now say that in the city of Cape Town, our active cases is starting to plateau in. So it's starting to stabilize. If you look at the bottom, you will see that yellow is Garden Route. Garden Route has come off a peak, and it's like Nelson Mandela and like Buffalo City, it is already declining because it started earlier than the other areas in the Western Cape. You can see Cape Winans is also starting to stabilize. Overberg is also starting to stabilize. And then West Coast is the only one that is still inclining, but we're expecting that to start stabilizing during this week or early next week. If you look at the Cape Town sub-district on the right-hand side, we have a very interesting picture on this one. In that, if you look at the line that is the lowest in the second wave, that is Khayelitsha, the sub-district. And you can see that Khayelitsha in the second wave, what is stabilizing now at cases, is at least less than half of what it was in the first wave. So Khayelitsha was one of the more affected cases, places in the first wave. In the second wave, it's much lower. You look at all the other areas that goes with it. Klipfontein is the second lowest, and then Mitchells Plain, the third lowest in the second wave. All the other areas in the metro has recorded significantly higher levels in the second wave compared to the first wave. If we then go to a provincial overview, you will see that there is a stabilization of cases as I've reported to you. The ones on the top gives you that cases. To the left bottom is the case positivity rate, then the admissions over the last 7 days, and then to the right bottom is the death rate. So you can see a picture of us entering or stabilizing into a peak for the second wave. If you take the metro, that's the picture that I just spoke to you about. It's a different way of looking at the metro. You can then see overall stabilization in the metro. Right, left top, you can see that Khayelitsha has been stabilizing for about 2 weeks now and starting to decline. You can see that Klipfontein at the bottom left is also similarly stabilizing and coming down, and Mitchells Plain next to it. And then if you look at the right-hand side, you can see Southern and Western also stabilizing. The area that is not stabilized in the metro as fast as these other ones is Eastern and Northern, and then also Tigerberg, but we also now starting to see a bit of stabilization of those areas. In the rural areas, left bottom, very clear, Garden Route has stabilized. If you look at the right, complete the right bottom, the Central Karoo has got very small numbers. So Central Karoo, whenever there's an outbreak, it has a peak, but it's small numbers. If you look at Cape Winans in the middle at the bottom, it's like the Cape Metro, slightly behind Cape Metro, but stabilizing. And then you can see Overberg, the left, started to stabilize, but West Coast is still increasing, and it has not quite reached its peak yet. This is, let's call it the wastewater system that we look at. So we have three municipalities currently. What they do is, at the wastewater plants, they have a mechanism to measure the content and quality in the water of the presence of... Sorry, sir.
This is Dr. Zamo calling. There's an emergency that is taking me out of the meeting for now.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Jacobs to continue with the meeting while I'm attending to this challenge, but the list of those who want to speak is already appearing there, Dr. Jacobs, on our chat group. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good luck. Hope it's not serious. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Love chat. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Jacobs. Can I proceed?
Yes, certainly.
Thank you, sir. So the wastewater is, it's a measurement of the, let's call it the wastewater as it goes into the runoff, and it's tracking the presence of COVID and the measurement that you see. So in the meter on the left-hand side, the City of Cape Town has done it the longest. You will see in Klipjebel, Westvleer, Scottsdene, Zandvliet, and Krasenstein, those are all the areas that I mentioned, which is, in a sense, northern and eastern. You can see there is still significant COVID there. So what has been very good with this system, wherever we had high cases, the wastewater actually corroborated that, because it showed us that that's awesome. But the interesting one in the metro, actually, there's lower levels than before around the airport area and around all recreational facilities. And that was in keeping with the new regulations and restrictions of movement of people, that those areas are also lower. In Breede Valley, yeah, Rosenwald used to be quite high. You could see quite a big peak there, and it came down. And those rivers that were are now up, and that's in line with the reported cases in Breede Valley. And then in Overberg, there were increases in Botterveer and also Beliesdorp, which is very much in line with the number of reported cases. So this has been a very useful system for us. And when you reduce your cases, this is a very sensitive early warning system that there might be pockets of cases. So this system will stand us in good stead for a potential next wave and early detection once it's been completely institutionalized. The garden route is just to show the decrease in cases, hospitalization, and also deaths. If I then go to our health platform capacity, because that is quite a big part of what we're doing now, just to explain to very much to everyone, our primary care facilities is where people present for testing, but they also get triaged with confirmed cases that need oxygen to get into hospital. We've had to de-escalate quite a lot of the non-COVID primary care services, and we've maintained a system we started in the first wave, which is home delivery of medicines to people that they don't have to come to health facilities to collect the medication. And that's been a roaring success in our system. The hospital capacity is the big issue. We have 7,600 total acute operational public sector beds. That is, if you take the psychiatric hospital beds, the TB hospital beds, the Red Cross, Mowbray, you take them all out. And in this total beds of 7,600, that's all the general and critical care public sector beds where COVID patients can be admitted into. And we use a figure called operational bed number, which will differ day to day because an operational bed requires staffing and all the things that you need to be able to put the patients into the bed. Then, quite importantly, a subset of the 7,600 beds, which is 626 intermediate care beds, that has been provisioned in the metro. There is 336 beds in intermediate care facilities called Brackengate. There's 90 at Lentegeer in two wards. The one is the 3-year ward, the other one is ward 90. And then from the 1st of January, we opened 200 additional intermediate care beds at Mitchell's Plain Hospital of Hope. And that has been brought online incrementally. We also have 64 intermediate care beds at Swanscraal Hospital. 5 has been added recently in Paarl. And we have opened, sorry for that Dr. Tigger there, we've opened 20 of the potential additional 136 intermediate care beds we can still bring online, but we've opened 20 already. Fatalities management, that is dealing with the dead bodies. In the metro, we have a center where 336 bodies can be accommodated at any given time. The City of Cape Town has retained an additional 96 spaces for us. There's currently 101 people, and that number goes up and down as undertakers take the bodies away, and the team has been working on this to make sure that wherever there's a challenge, it's been problem solved. So that's all the way from the undertakers, the coffins, to the crematorium, to what's in the mortuary. There's been a very strict system to move all of those logistics on a daily basis where we find ourselves now. So this is the hospitalization I referred to earlier. You can see that the top green line is the public sector hospitalization. It is starting to peak. It's not increasing. It's not decreasing yet. So the pressure is still very much there. And the same pattern is with the public, with the private sector hospitals. Currently, we have 3,300 COVID patients in all our field hospitals, 1,800 in the public sector hospital, 1,400 in private sector. That excludes people under investigation and cases in specialized hospital settings. Now, COVID hospitalization has stabilized, but while we continue to still experience psychiatric pressure, trauma has decreased significantly, and I'll come back to the trauma issue. The Metro hospitals has an occupancy now of about 93%, George Lane area 61, Paul 74, Worcester 73. I'll show those figures again. And then all of this together, COVID and PUIs now currently make up 35% of all available acute general hospital beds across the province. The intermediate care, the hospital of Open Brackengate has 305 patients, Frisia and Ward 90 at 67, Mitchell's Plain at 92, Swansdale currently at 60. And these numbers also change day by day. So this is just a little bit on the testing. Just to tell you that in this province we test about 22,000 people per week. There's been a significant issue that has helped us with the antigen testing. It's at all hospitals we're doing antigen testing. It helps us. It's also now being dealt in districts for the outbreak. So like the Eastern Cape, this has been a big issue for us to be able to use antigen testing. If you then go to the acute platform, currently we've also brought online temporary tents. So at Kailicha, Bensplier, Mitchell's Plain, Eastern River, Elderberg, Carl Bremen, Brackengate, that is to streamline the admission and the discharge. And in instance, Brackengate, there is the highest turnover. We have 2 tents for admissions and for discharges. And then the fantastic system that we put in place, all our EMS colleagues, and that's the EMS, together with the Department of Transport Public Works, the repurposed taxi service, a very streamlined transport system, is to make sure that people move rapidly from where they are to where they need to be in a hospital bed, to create space all the time, and then also rapid discharges home to make sure that the capacity doesn't at any given time build up back into the EC. And they've maintained that on a day-to-day basis over the last 14 to 15 to 21 days to make sure that we never get full congestion of the platform at any given time. Just to illustrate that point to you, not a single public sector hospital EC has closed at any time during the last 21 days, whereas on a daily basis, the private sector hospitals in the Western Cape varies between 7 to 8 to 10 private hospitals at any given time, closing their doors because they are congested with too many patients. Then our data system is also, our team has put a dashboard together where we look at oxygen utilization, daily bed availability, staffing, and we pull all of that together in one system. This is an example of the daily operational bed status. That's the one I spoke to you about. You see the 7,600 beds broken down into the Cape Metro, the George area, the Paarl area, the Worcester area. You can see the bed occupancy for non-COVID and the bed occupancy for COVID status. And the total percentage, 35% across all. On the right-hand side is a breakdown between the wards for COVID and the critical care for COVID. And you can understand that critical care is under more pressure because it's fewer beds than it is the general wards for COVID. And this dashboard is broken down per hospital, per ward, per facility in the entire province, and it gets updated 1 o'clock every day. This is our oxygen use. You can see that about 70% of the total oxygen produced in the province we use, that's 70 tons at the Kales River plant. We can see that our use in the public sector has exceeded 47 tons per day. And just to compare that for what it was, in the first wave, we peaked at 27 tons per day. The average for the 12 months before that was 12 tons a day. So you can see before COVID, we used about 12 tons a day. At the peak of the first wave, we used 27 tons. Now, at the peak of where we are now, we're using about 48 tons just for the public sector in the Western Cape for oxygen. So just to explain that to you, the combined utilization, public and private together, is currently about 73 tons per day. we consume 70% of it, the private sector 31%. But the combined utilization is above the maximum production capacity of Aprox in the Western Cape, which is 70 tons. And therefore, Aprox has been driving in additional oxygen on a daily basis into the province to augment the supplies. So there's currently 5 bulk oxygen tankers. It's all allocated to make sure that all the hospitals have oxygen in the tanks. This morning's report is there's about 200, there's about 180 tons of oxygen in the tanks across all our hospitals, private and public. And in the spare, the storage tank, we've now gone to 120 tons of oxygen in storage. So that's surplus oxygen if need to be called upon. So in a sense, we've stabilized the oxygen situation, but we will continue monitoring it over the next 2 weeks. Fatalities management, really quickly, a group is looking after all of this across all the areas. They have mass fatality plans, the city of Cape Town and the 5 districts, each one has it. The support from Home Affairs to make sure that there's additional office hours, additional registration of deaths. The capacity and the functioning of crematoria, we work very clearly where there were backlogs. We make sure that they can function overnight, over weekends, to make sure backlogs are cleared. And in the working group has been monitoring the available storage space across the province and has resolved problems as they have arrived. This is just an example. It's a bit of too much detail, but just to give you an example. This was the 6th of January, and each day this gets updated. You can see then, this is just an example from the city of Cape Town. How many mortuary shelves are there? How many mortuary shelves are occupied? How many mortuary shelves are available? So for that day, 336 mortuary shelves, 81 was occupied, and 255 was available. And this gets monitored on a daily basis across each of the districts in terms of this. So you can see on the 6th of January, there were 2,690 shelves, 1,500 for the whole province were occupied, and 1,143 shelves were available. And this mass fatality center that I spoke to you about is really a release valve to the system. If there's any pressures anywhere, we move the bodies into that place as a temporary holding space to give relief, just in case there is many more bodies that the whole system can cope with. And this has been very admirably managed by the team over this time. Then the non-COVID, sorry about that, Chairperson. Okay, sorry about that slide. That is it's a wrong place slide. The point, can I just say to what should be in the slide, I will correct this and forward it to you. The slide here is really should talk about that we had psychiatric pressures, we had trauma pressures, and there's a whole lot of things that we had to make sure from a non-COVID perspective that we had to downscale to make place for COVID. So the big problem for us was trauma. So the question could be, how have the recent alcohol regulations affected hospital trauma presentations? So we have this system in place at 5 hospitals, and we've been tracking it ever since the alcohol restrictions came in. So what this shows you here, it shows you that up until the 30th of December, there were no alcohol restrictions. It shows you what the pattern was like. Then on the 15th of December, there was the Monday to Thursday restriction. You can see what the impact of that was from the 15th of December to the 27th of December. Then the president on the 28th of December introduced the total alcohol ban. And you can see the massive impact that has had in the last 2 weeks. So this has been a significant decrease in trauma across our hospitals because of the alcohol ban. This is what it looks like in figures. So the 2 weeks prior to the ban, the peak of cases was 157 cases at these 5 hospitals on Boxing Day. After the peak, the maximum on New Year's Day was actually only 66 cases in the 5 hospitals. That's just an average of 11 cases across the 5 hospitals. If you look at the median, which is the average number of cases, before the ban, it was 76 cases on average. That dropped to 43 cases on average. So you can see there's a 51% cases, a drop in cases, on average cases, but a 58% drop in peak from Boxing Day to New Year. And if you compare this New Year's Day 2020 to New Year's Day 2021, a 65% drop in cases year on year, just for New Year's Day, of a maximum of 186 dropping to 66, and the average being 69 dropping to 39. And so this is the experience that has been seen, not just in the Western Cape, but across the country. Then our healthcare workers is our last input. I'm mindful of the time, Chairperson, I'll be very quick on this. This is a dashboard that we have now that we update every day. This is cumulatively of our healthcare infections and the people active as of yesterday. So it's updated this morning, it gets updated tomorrow, whatever. So as of yesterday morning, there were 1,029 people active, healthcare workers that were not working. 98 of them were doctors, 442 were nurses, 23 were radiographers, 7 were pharmacists, 459 were all other categories of staff, which is clerical staff, cleaners, people working in the kitchen, all of those. Unfortunately, you could see that we have lost 92 staff members since the start of the first. In the first wave, we lost about 60. In the second wave, it's now about 30 people. And that is the trauma that is currently being experienced by people. A, you know that your colleagues are infected. They have to come back when they be isolated. But you also now know of colleagues that is hospitalized, and then you hear of colleagues that have died. So this is, if you take each of those infections, we have it per facility, per geographic area, and we're going to say how many staff members are out of work or at home isolating in each hospital or each area, so that we can plan where is our staffing deployment strategy to meet the staffing need to be able to continue the service. And so we've been actively trying to fill posts. You can see that we've offered 435 new posts over the last 2 weeks, of which 286 people have already started to work, and we manage this on a day-to-day basis. And this is just for nursing, because that's the biggest critical mass that we needed to fill. The vaccine strategy is probably the most powerful thing that we can do. The national procurement process started. National Minister announced last week to this committee the 1.5 billion doses, million doses for the country. That's ongoing, and we're focusing on implementing in this province. So this is our objectives. We want to reduce mortality, morbidity in vulnerable people. We want to reduce community transmissions to herd immunity. That's the ultimate objective, but also to protect the healthcare system. And we're guided by the framework for South Africa, the science, the ethics, and implementation, and we are implementing accordingly. So phase one, phase two, and phase three, our plans are underway for phase one. We currently think that there's 100,000 people that should be immunized as healthcare workers. We're currently going through the process of verifying every single person and putting them on the register so that we can have an exact figure by the end of next week. This is our governance arrangements. There's a committee that I oversee, then there's a small committee that does all of this. We've appointed an expert advisory committee. They're meeting today. They help us with all the technical expert issues, the issues around ethics and all of those. There's also a private sector coordinating committee which we're meeting tomorrow, and we're bringing this all together. We're looking at social mobilization, talking to stakeholders. We met with organized labor on Monday. We're meeting with our own staff and with the private sector this week. And then we go to the religious leaders and all the other sectors as of next week. We have operations logistics. We have a team that's specifically just looking where is the vaccine going to be stored, how many people need to be vaccinated, where are we going to set it up, at which place. And then the big thing is the information system to be able to register everyone, track the vaccines, track the stock, monitor adverse events, and then like the dashboard, we would like to see a vaccine dashboard that as we vaccinate on a daily basis, tell people this is the people that's been vaccinated in all the categories and all the geographic areas. A local geographic areas, we're going to work with everybody to look at vaccine at all the sites in a geographic area. And this is the process. There will be pre-registration and accreditation of all health facilities where vaccination will happen. Pre-accreditation of vaccinators. There will be a registration, a register for vaccine, so it's like a voter's roll, of which all the healthcare workers will go first. But for phase two, it's all the other essential workers and everybody that's vulnerable. And then for phase three, the balance of the people. We're working very closely with the IEC because we're drawing from their experience of doing voting. And we're learning quite a lot of their insights in what we're doing. Then there's an appointment process. Everybody will get an appointment. Then you will get your first vaccine. You'll have consent. First dose, appointment the second dose, and a proof that you've been vaccinated, and an electronic proof on the system that that nobody can come back for a second vaccine or whatever, but because we do it in that way. But you've also been given your appointment for your second dose. So we're waiting the SAHPRA regulations in relation to the use of the vaccine, and we assume that SAHPRA will recommend that people must get two doses, because that's the efficacy of the science in terms of that. It's all supported by adequate supplies, infrastructure, people, and data systems. So communication is going to be so crucial. We want to mobilize people. There's a thing that we want to say, let's unite to vaccinate, and we want to get everybody to work together. Then build vaccination confidence. We want to address the medical concerns, the religious and cultural concerns, and this mass misinformation that is currently building up via social media, so that we put the right information out for people, but also the information about logistics, availability, and acceptability. Stakeholder engagement, I already touched on this. It has to be all sectors. We're working with organized labor, civil society, and our communities, our religious communities, and other stakeholders. And we're going to do it at provincial level, district level, and local municipality level. And the information system is going to track. It's a national system that we support. We have some contingency in place if there's a delay, but it's really just to capture all the data so you can put it on the dashboard and you know exactly what's happening to everyone. And generally, it's a huge opportunity to build a movement for better health, unite people, to get a good foundation for universal health coverage, and to remind people that this does not replace a non-pharmaceutical intervention like mask wearing and hand washing, so that we can still do all of that and still remain safe until the herd immunity is achieved. So in conclusion, Chairperson, there's early signs that we've entered the peak of the second wave with early signs of stabilization. Our local teams remain on high alert to pick up any outbreaks and respond to them. Our concern is still non-adherence to protective behavior, hence the targeted law enforcement with the new regulations is quite important for us, and that must be maintained. And then the hospitalization mortality is still a highly pressurized situation. Although it's stabilizing, it is still under pressure, and we need to be very vigilant to reduce new cases. We've had a very positive experience of alcohol-related trauma, and we've shown that very clearly. Our health workers have and continue to face significant physical and emotional stress. I can't stress this enough. People are emotionally and physically traumatized. Healthcare workers as part of families, families are traumatized, and healthcare workers as part of the broader society. Communities and societies and families are emotionally and mentally completely traumatized. I cannot stress enough the fact that we have brought online in our health facilities the on-site trauma debriefing and psychological counseling and debriefing. They are virtually in every place where we currently, every hospital, every facility where people ask for. And we get a report on the themes, and it's heartbreaking, the themes that comes out of it. There is so much trauma. We're going to have to heal, mourn and heal, and do it in a deliberate way to take our health workers through that. Thank you, Chairperson. My apologies for going slightly over time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, HOD, for the wonderful presentation. I see we're rushing towards the end. Honourable members, we need to just take note of the time that is left. We said we want to finish at 12:30. We're now at 8 minutes to 12. If you can keep your questions as brief as possible. And then we'll give an opportunity to the department and the MEC. So just follow without me having to urge you on. Second is Tirwa, Honourable Tirwa, Honourable Pope, Gayela, Sufis, Tempaquayo, Wilson, and Spengwa. And I will be at the end. Thank you. You may start.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much to the Provincial Department for your presentation. Allow me first of all to congratulate you on the Hospital of Hope facility that you put up. I think it's a wonderful facility, and indeed I think it'll go a long way in serving the interests of those people, particularly those tested positive. But really, indeed, I think it's a fantastic facility. But having said that, I'd like you to comment on the fact that the latest statement by Professor Karim, who says that there is no guarantee that the vaccine is going to work. We are in the second variant. when the vaccine was developed, which I think is a miracle because it was developed in 6 months, something we couldn't do in 30 years when it comes to HIV and AIDS. But having said that, his own word is there is no guarantee, so we'll have to check. If it works, well and good. If not, we'll have to do further research. Now that, together with the fact that we were expecting to save a lot of lives in South Africa by rolling out this vaccine, I'd like you to comment and tell me. But more importantly on that point, I see you mentioned SAHPRA as well. SAHPRA has not approved the vaccine. SAHPRA has not approved. In South Africa, ought to have been rolled out unless it's approved by SAHPRA. But we've ordered, we paid $283 billion. I'd like you to comment on that. The other thing is this, you know, you talk about a 40% positivity rate. I think it's come down from about 50%. There are some experts that are reporting, questioning the accuracy of this report. And I think in one of the countries, I think it's in Portugal, this matter went to court, and they found that 97 out of 100 was false positive. So could you tell us, because I'm concerned as to the, you know, with the test results and the number of positive patients testing positive. So that's you have now established a serious problem in the Western Cape, like countrywide, in terms of alcohol and diabetes. I want you to tell us what measures you intend putting in place for COVID-19 in this particular province, because Western Cape is the diabetes capital, I think, or city of the country at the moment, and we know what the situation is. How are you going to be able to try and deal with this problem of diabetes and alcohol in Zambia? Now, the other thing is this, the issue I want to go back to. In the absence of a vaccine at this stage, in the absence of a cure, with the statement by the Command Council that there's no guarantee that vaccine is going to work, and we hope it's going to work, because whatever we do, we must take as many measures as possible to try and prevent it. Have you ever considered looking at the statistics and the research, and I've asked your other counterparts the same question, into the issue of ivermectin, because the evidence that's unfolding is overwhelming from throughout the world. 100% success rate. In fact, the minimum I've seen in all the research is 83% drop in mortality rate all over the world. And I will take you back to, I think, which I said earlier on, the Helsinki, I think in 1964, where it was agreed and passed that if a particular drug is not registered, provided there's substantial evidence in order to save life, we need to be able to roll it out. I want to know whether you have actually considered that. And lastly, I think I'll just go to, could you tell us now what is the latest in terms of the recovery rate for people that are admitted to hospitals and the ICUs and ventilation? I know at one stage it was 3 out of 5 of the hospitals that were getting better, and I think the fatal, mortality rate was quite high. But anyway, I have many other questions, but I think I'm under a very difficult circumstances. Guys are working in the Western Cape. I just think that under the circumstances, I think you are trying to contain the virus. But lastly, I want to say, together with that, do you speak to your command council at the provincial level to make sure that there's compliance? Because I go around all the time to supermarkets, retail businesses, lift buildings, and I see the level of compliance is so low, which is aggravating the situation, making it difficult. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask questions in relation to worker infection rates. We know that it's very high in the Western Cape, and not so long ago, health workers stated in a media report that some workers are being forced to come to work even though they are positive, so long as they are not presenting with symptoms or asymptomatic. How true is this, and what has the province done following this to investigate the accuracy of the claim, and what have you done to ensure that this doesn't happen again under your watch, if it does indeed happen? Secondly, what is the province's plan to ensure that health workers are protected? There clearly isn't enough being done to ensure worker safety. In relation to this, health workers in the province have been greatly impacted by lack of community education on COVID-19 prevention and vaccination. What has the department done? What will you do to ensure that this stigma
is responded to adequately and education is placed at the center of ensuring the curbing of the virus. It becomes futile to have a vaccine strategy if community education is not prioritized. Your outcome will be no different to the HIV and AIDS ARV strategy program that stagnates because communities so far from lack of information and have to go to great lengths with curia. This to the detriment of healthcare workers at the end of the day. Why then are you still spending more money on billboards when community radio stations not only offer adequate reach to communities on information, but also offer an opportunity of engagement as well, instead of some blank paper on the street that you don't even get a chance to engage with someone else? Can you also have clarity on the worker replacement system, on who is assisting the 1,029 vacant posts of COVID-positive healthcare workers in the province? Because it was not made quite clear if the 1,029 posts have volunteers in the meantime, or are they being filled, or are just being vacant as 1,029 and we're waiting for them to recover. Only 10% of the population utilize private health care, while 80% use public health care. The current oxygen ratio between private and public in the Western Cape is 59 to 31, 31% being private sector. How does the province plan to close the gap to ensure that those who rely on public health care also have a higher probability of accessing oxygen in public facilities, and that their poverty doesn't disadvantage them when there is a Department of Health for being charged that is essentially tasked with this overall? And lastly, as a province that greatly models economic disparity across racial lines and have received great critique for not being responsive enough to address how this affects access to quality health care, how different is your response to informal settlement inspections in regard to prevention, education, and community-based caring, since the make of how and where people live directly impacts how they experience COVID-19 as a pandemic? How then, as a province, have you created a peculiar system and strategy for colored and black communities in informal settlements who don't have the liberty to isolate or social distance by virtue of living in an informal settlement? I'm also asking this because field hospitals in Khayelitsha are overcrowded, and yet there hasn't been an intervention from the province to address this. When will you address overcrowding in Khayelitsha facilities? Just mixing this question with the last question that I posed to you. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to you, Dr. Tete and Dr. Mbombo. I've got about 4 questions that I'd like addressed, please. You mentioned in your presentation that areas such as, for instance, certain sub-districts in the metro, for instance, like Khayelitsha and others that you mentioned that were hard hit in the first wave aren't perhaps being as badly hit in this wave. And I'd like to understand why that is. I mean, is it either through your interventions as a department, or is there some kind of level of herd immunity that you're starting to see? What are the trends, and what do you think is the reasoning why, you know, there's some kind of difference between how certain sub-districts that were really badly hit in the first wave aren't as badly hit in this one? Then the second question is, due to the significant pressure, and you mentioned this in numerous times, particularly how it's affecting healthcare workers, the pressure on the system is tremendous. And I know that the province has built you know, intermediate facilities to be able to ease pressures at certain facilities, but what kind of measures are you taking? Because obviously, I mean, now we are in the middle of a second wave, and healthcare workers are stretched, as you say. And so what other interventions are there, or is the province looking into to be able to ease the pressure at actual facilities, particularly where it concerns non-COVID related illnesses? Because obviously with those being ignored, they soon become crisis to be managed. So if people, for instance, are not you know, taking their diabetic medication, then soon that you're going to have a different problem on your hands. And so I'd like to understand just some key interventions that the province is looking at doing to make sure that you are also dealing with your non-COVID related issues so that they don't become a crisis, and also what kind of interventions are you putting in place despite the facilities that are being provided elsewhere to be able to augment the kind of service that you're providing.
because clearly we're going to be here for some time, and obviously any system is as resilient as contingency plans. So I'd like to know that. Then the other issue is around, you mentioned the 48 tons of oxygen usage in the province. Before you guys, we had the Eastern Cape come and present, and one of the issues that they also raised was the fact that AFROX, which is the key supplier of oxygen, is completely battling with meeting the demands that they have. And so, you know, you have made a provision for extra supply.
I didn't catch that. Could you try again?
While you've made provisions for extra provision of oxygen, is there no way in which the province can look at diversifying the supply of oxygen? Because obviously if ACOS is feeling the pressure in the Eastern Cape, in the Western Cape, and are they the only supplier that's able or has the capacity to produce at the level that you require? And has the province looked at diversifying supply? Because, you know, I dread to think if AFROX starts to throttling supply, what would happen, particularly considering the fact that there has been a complete acknowledgement that oxygen at this point is a very critical intervention. Then I want to just close off by asking about the vaccine distribution and logistics. You have very detailed plans and more details than we've seen in so far. And so that's good, but I would have wanted to see a little bit more about what are some of the logistics in terms of onboarding your district. So, you know, are there plans in place for storage, transportation, allocation, and distribution of the vaccine, not just in the metro, but also in your rural district? So when you go into Beaufort West, for instance, what is the plan there? Because the Beaufort West district is very different from the metro. And so have those things been considered? Are you ready to onboard your district in order for them to be ready for distribution? Then lastly, for instance, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, it requires two doses. And so what is going to be the strategy of the province? Are you going to be rolling out all doses to healthcare workers and then hope to meet the deadline of the second dose? Or are you going to try and target all healthcare workers with the supply that we have, considering the fact that nationally we don't have a very steady supply of the vaccine and there aren't any concrete deadlines and so or timelines? And so what is the province doing to mitigate a situation where we vaccinated 100,000 healthcare workers and they're waiting for the second dose and that doesn't arrive? Thank you very much, Chip.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation. Some of the questions are being asked by my colleagues, Chairperson, but I want to ask some of the few questions. The first one, Chair, is about the new COVID-19 admission to hospitals, 50% higher. I just want to check with the department, how do you plan to manage this? Then the second one is that facilities in the metro and rural areas running under pressure, particularly with regard to oxygen supply. How are you going to address that challenge? As Western Cape, any plan that you have, if you can just share with us. Then the other one is the issue of shortage of staff. When are you going to fill the vacant post? But you also, I've seen in the media that you have engaged a nursing agency to help the department with the shortage of staff. Then if we can get the clarity, how far with that process. The other issue is the issue of Stellenbosch Hospital Medical Manager, Dr. Richard, said 85 beds are needed in that hospital. So we want to know actually if you address that as a Western province. Then the last one, Chair, is the issue of ICUs at Hot Springs and also Tyrebeek are full. What is the plan to address that? I know that you don't want what is it, temporary structures in that province, but what is the plan of addressing that? Because we can see that you have also a higher of number of people who are dying in the province. Then the last one, Chepesini, is the issue of recovery. I have seen in the presentation that you have also highlighted the issue of staff members who were infected by COVID-19. But I want to know what is the recovery percentage of health workers in the province, if we can just get also that report from the HOD and also the MEC. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable speakers here, and I just want to say thank you to the Western Cape for a well-prepared and presented presentation, and thank you for acknowledging the trauma of health workers. I would add that there is a collective trauma that we are experiencing as a nation. Chair, I have to say that I will make this submission as a person who lives in the Western Cape, and in the last couple of months during this pandemic, I had first-hand experience of the level of care and the level or the quality of health services in the province. The situation on the ground is far removed from the picture the MEC painted or the well-presented presentation. In fact, there is a growing mistrust in the healthcare system, with many people too afraid to go to hospital when they deteriorate. And it is my contention that this growing mistrust could be attributed to the fact that public hospitals are not as congested as private facilities. We had reports of people being triaged for EMS services, patients unable to be moved to Tygerberg because of the risk of moving them from high-flow oxygen, patients who are in desperate need of high-flow oxygen at the district hospital having to wait for high-flow oxygen before finishing their too little machine. On Monday, I received a call, just this Monday, of someone who waited 4 hours to be placed on low-flow oxygen. And in December, in the Elderberg district, only 2 ambulances were available for the whole region. So the real-life experience in terms of the people of the Western Cape is far removed from the world-class presentation or intelligence system that is mentioned here. I have a few questions that I will add here. The one is, the Western Cape has a much higher number of fatalities, as mentioned by Honourable Gela, per 1,000 people infected when it is compared to a province like Gauteng. What are the critical areas that contribute to this high fatality rate, and what interventions are you planning to ensure this trend is reversed? What can you do now, and just as important, what are you planning for the third and fourth wave? Could you please provide us with the stats on where deaths occur, how many deaths at district hospital versus a tertiary hospital, and how many hospitals, and how many of the deaths at district level occurred with patients that were intubated or waiting for ICU admission at a tertiary hospital? Then fourthly, I want to emphasize what Honorable Chiwa has so eloquently explained, and we have said this in the previous meetings as well. Community-based care would alleviate a lot of pressure from hospitals. What is being done to incorporate home-based care for the moderately ill? And is there a community care plan in place to implement in our communities, especially our poorer communities? And then lastly, Chair, I think the fatality seems to be linked with late presentation at hospital for care. So by the time the patient go to hospitals, they already have very low oxygen saturation levels. And our constituencies need reliable information as to how to manage themselves if they are in COVID. Can you give us examples of how you are communicating on how to manage COVID at home? When to seek medical at COVID at home? I'm going I will directly as well, but I should be. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question is based on the phase one plan. The presenter, Dr. Kluge, mentioned that phase one plan will be available next week, and that is in actual fact the content, the clear plan that we were expecting from the presenter. But since he said the plan will be available next week, I just would like to ask whether the very same plan will be made available to us and when, so that we can be on par with the department's development. Under vaccination administration, there is consent indicated. I just would like to ask whether there is a consent form available that will be signed, and if there is that consent form during the vaccination, can it be also be made available to us so that we can check the contents of the form, because usually people just sign, attach signatures without reading clearly what they are signing for. And still on that note, I just want to ask to say, is the vaccine that is going to be administered be on voluntary or mandatory basis, and is the communication going to be done clearly in the simplest term to those that will be receiving vaccine? How many Cuban doctors are deployed in your province? If there are, in which facilities are they deployed? The following one, I'm repeating what has been said, to say there is a considerable number of health workers who are suffering from fatigue, whether we like it or not. It's a reality as it's experienced by the health workers. What is being done? Clear plan of what is being done about this. And the last one, did you receive any donations from the gift of givers of oxygen machines? If yes, how is that contribution helping you solve the shortage of oxygen in the province? I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think in the main I'm covered. Thank you to the Western Cape for an outstanding presentation. Much appreciated. I think my questions are generally covered by my colleagues. I just have one comment to make. Today's headlines in News 24 is that AstraZeneca cannot stop COVID-19 acting in South Africa despite the government's plans of being in talks for months. So you have explained to us your vaccine rollout, whether or not it's going to now happen, whether or not we're going to get the AstraZeneca, is now obviously in question, because it would appear that there's been a lack of transparency on that front. But can you tell me, NEC and HOD, have you had any direct contacts with vaccine suppliers or vaccine developers? And have you been able to put pressure on or get any information that would have possibly assisted the national government in the procurement of vaccines? Because I think at this stage that is the biggest concern. And, you know, particularly after today's headlines, even more concerning. If we really are going to get ahead of COVID, vaccines are a critical part of what we need to do, and if they're not available, we're going to struggle. I would appreciate your feedback on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me first welcome the report, a comprehensive report. Having said that, I have few questions. Number one, in line with the department's three-pronged approach to contain the COVID-19 infection rates in the Western Cape, what measures are in place to ensure that every person gets specialized medical care in, if and when they need? Has the existing medical structure been sufficient to meet the demand? Secondly, it has been noted that many healthcare professionals are advocating for the use of the injection as an effective drug to treat COVID-19. What is the Western Cape Department of Health position in this regard? Are you in continuous contact with the National Department of Health? And are you independent researching for alternative and novel medical treatments that might help alleviation in the suffering of citizens infected with COVID-19? Having said that, could you give us a clear understanding in terms of side effects of vaccine? Is there any measure put in place to overcome with this side effect or implication? I thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I think we covered all of the members except for myself. I only have 3 points to raise, and I'm going to be cognizant here of the time constraints which we have. The first one would be on the vaccine. I think just to answer mention to the point that was raised by Honorable Wilson, we must understand that the AstraZeneca vaccine is being manufactured in India. And I think the company is calling it as SII, and it's exactly the same vaccine that we will be receiving in South Africa towards the end of the month. So I do not think the discrepancy is so huge in that we are not getting the AstraZeneca vaccine as was noted. Secondly, also on the vaccine, it was raised before that the province will be following, and today also by the HOD will be following the national guidelines with respect to procurement of the vaccine. And also thank you very much for a wonderful idea of what the rollout plan will be in the province. I actually like your presentation, that part of your presentation, very much. My next question will be on staffing. Of course, we have a great concern about the number of healthcare workers who we've lost due to the COVID, and also those in isolation and in quarantine throughout. A number of them I know very well, family members who work within the department. So we all have a concern for our healthcare workers. Now, this point of exhaustion and tiredness and being overwhelmed is very, very real. We need to have, and I'm sure, and I'm hoping that you will answer me what plans are in place to support them, especially their mental health, and for certain rotations, etc. And what have you done with regards to the community service, healthcare professionals, these medical nursing, and allied health professionals who have now finished their COPSIRV time, whether you've expedited taking them up into the service so as to provide that kind of buffer or opportunity for the others to get some rest. Of course, we are looking towards a third and fourth wave as people will be returning to work, as people are returning to the province, and to schools, colleges, universities, etc. My question here is, any work that has been done on our existing facilities, because we've seen that the province is not really reliant on temporary structures more than what we invest in temporary structures. We are hoping that the work that is being performed is of sufficient quality that it would be able to continue and be in existence. And here I would refer to things like reticulation of oxygen pipes, any other refurbishment of wards, recommissioning of wards and decommissioning of others, etc. We are hoping, and I would hope that these kind of changes which are made would be more of a temporary structure that is really providing the future a better healthcare service delivery in our province. Thank you very much. Let me just speak about the time issues here. HMD and MEC, I think it's 12:24. I guess we did have to go on until you are done, whether that be just before 1 or 1 o'clock. But we'd appreciate your replies to all of the points raised. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to honourable members for the input. I think to save time, Chair, I'll ask the HOD to go first with some of these are technical, and then I'll do last and do the closing as well, summarising some of those that would have been left out. Thank you. Over you to Dr. Casey.
Thank you very much, Minister. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the members. Thank you for the very insightful questions. Just to start off with, the issue about whether the vaccine is effective against the new variant. We share the views of Professor Karim, and the only people that can pronounce on that is the scientists in our country. And there is a group of scientists currently looking at this, and they will tell us the effectiveness of the current vaccine against the variant that we have, and we're expecting that pronouncement to come pretty soon. Just also to talk about SAHPRA, we are familiar with the fact that SAHPRA is processing the application for the Serum Institute. So as Dr. Jacob says, this is the Serum Institute in India who is producing the vaccine, which is the vaccine that was trialed in the AstraZeneca trial. So this is very clear that this is the Serum Institute vaccine, and we know that the SAHPRA currently for the member that asked the question, SAHPRA is currently processing it, and we know and we're expecting a pronouncement, if not by the end of this week, early next week, from SAHPRA in relation to this. The question about accuracy of the test, there's been many international questions about the PCR test, and there's been many people questioning the validity of the test and the issue about test positivity, test negativity, and all of those. We are guided by the National Institute for Communicable Disease, NICD, and we're guided by the virologists that work in that setting. So again, SAHPRA does not approve any use of any product in this country unless it's gone through a validation. So each of the tests have been validated independently in this province, in this country, sorry. And I'm pretty familiar because there are three big labs in the Western Cape, and I'm aware of these tests being validated before they were used. The same with the antigen test, the same with any antibody test, it's all validated, and SAHPRA only gives approval if those things are approved. So we work on the assumption that the SAHPRA approval is that with local testing, the validity of those tests has been proven through our local thing. That's a very important question about alcohol and diabetes. I'm going to be very short. We learned from the first wave about diabetes, and I'll come back to some of the questions some of the other members asked. But we have learned so much about diabetes through COVID. It completely changes the way we view diabetes and how it should be managed as a chronic disease or a disease of chronic lifestyle. So we are hoping out of COVID comes a complete relook at the prevention aspects, the early detection, the management, the control of diabetes, and I think if COVID brings us one thing in the Western Cape, it's a complete relook at the way we look at diabetes. And there's some exciting things that we will announce, because we have a group of people that has been phoning diabetic patients with COVID. And just by intervening with telemedicine and intervening and looking at their management daily, we've been able to bring down the mortality just for that week dissimulation to them. Alcohol is a very important issue. What this restriction showed us is how big an impact it has, not only on trauma, because we just measured trauma. We know it has a massive impact on gender-based violence, also violence against children, and therefore, and homicide. So there's a big question to be asked. In the Western Cape, Minister Mbombo and myself are very much involved with a safety priority, and because the health system measures the impact of unsafety, as a health sector, we've become involved in the safety plan for the Western Cape. So we will bring a public health view to this. To the member, I can guarantee we will look at a combination of restrictions, behavior modification, and what I would call societal redress to be able to impact, to deal with violence, with alcohol, the impact of alcohol. I'll deal with the ivermectin for once. I mean, I think my colleague from the Eastern Cape said the same thing. We are very much guided by the fact that we have SAPRA, but also an essentials medicine committee that SAPRA is depending on. The use for ivermectin currently is registered in this country by SAPRA as a veterinary medicine. Now, nobody can prescribe that medicine for human use until SAPRA says it is okay to do it. SAPRA is under tremendous pressure from many quarters, but they're doing what they've always done. They look at the evidence, they see if there's clinical trials, they will make a decision that's in the best interest of clinical medicine, and before anybody can prescribe it, SAPRA must give us permission to do that. And it's not the only medicine they're looking at. There's a whole range of other medicines, like the dexamethasone, and there's a few other things that they're looking at the same time. Then just to bring the issue of the hospitals and the recovery rate, the recovery rate is very much the same as we had in the first time. If somebody comes to hospital, the recovery rate is about 80% recovery rate. If you're in the ICU, your recovery rate is much lower. And our recovery rate still is above 50%. It's between 50 and 60%, and it's still maintained through this. Again, when we say we have a big death analysis, somebody else asks, we can give all that, we have all that detail. Every single death, where it happened, in which hospital, whether it was somebody that was in a hospital bed, in ICU bed, we got all of that detail in this full database of deaths. And I'll come back a little bit about the database and the perception that's created that we have higher fatality rates. I'll come back to that specific issue. And then the Command Council, very much engaging, and we are working with environmental health inspectors, with law enforcement, and you're very right, sir. There is a need to actually be very vigilant on all of those. The issues around healthcare infections and people being forced to work, we investigated that matter. There's absolutely no substance to the matter that any healthcare worker that is infected has been forced to work in the Western Cape. It's unemphatic, practically that's never happened, and there's no substance to the issue. And if it should happen, which it doesn't happen at all, we have very clear processes and procedures in place for a healthcare worker to register, and there will be obviously very clear disciplinary action taken if anybody is found guilty before somebody that is positive to work. The issue about community education is something that I shared dearly with a member, and similarly the member that raised the issue about community-based care and how do we manage COVID at home. Those things come together because community education is the center of it. So I'm going to answer the question about community education, about what is our approach towards poor communities in this Western Cape, and the issue about community-based care and managing COVID at home. They're all related. And the key issue is we have a policy that's called 2030. We have a policy that is now towards universal health coverage. The policy of the Western Cape Department of Health is to take an equity-based approach. So if you ask us how do we plan healthcare services, we plan it on the central theme of equity. We plan our resources in relation to where it's needed most, not equal distribution of resources. It's a fundamental principle of how we build things in terms of this. So therefore, where there's higher disease, where there's more healthcare needs, that is where our resources are redirected to in relation to our system. So that does bring me to the issue of why community health workers and a community-based care system is such a fundamental issue. Minister Mbombo has made it very clear that our universal health coverage strategy is on the basis of a strong community-orientated primary care system, of which community health workers is the bedrock of the system. So we will be investing significantly in a community-based system, and with that, we need to take community members with us, we need to take community healthcare workers with us, we need to actually have a very strong system, and we're very passionate about community-orientated primary care as the fundamental bedrock of our universal healthcare coverage system. Just in terms of worker replacement, the issue is that all the healthcare workers that are infected and are off duty, we have a few measures, and you're right, Dr. Jacobs, we have a measure of what we call retention of existing people that we can build. So 60% or 50% of what we want to do is to have people that whose contracts are coming to an end, to extend their contracts, to keep them in the system. The other 50% is to get new people into the system. That 50% is split into two ways. Is to get people via agencies. The success has not been that great. Agencies can't find anybody anywhere. I'm not sure about the other provinces when they're going to rely on agencies. It's very difficult for the agencies. But we still get some people by agencies. But the big thing is to offer people short contracts. And that's been a recruitment drive to do that. So therefore, when I show you the figures about bringing people in, it's a combination of extending contracts and it's a combination of getting new people in. And we put our focus on nursing specifically. And therefore, you can also notice we targeted where we need nursing for the new hospital beds that we must bring online and where the infection rate has been the highest and shifts have been affected. So it's a combination of all of those, but there's a team that looks at the detail per shift, per area, per hospital for bringing people into the system. Then the question about the first wave being hard hit in certain areas and then lesser hit in the second wave. The postulation, and it's a hypothesis, I'm going to just make it very clear to member Guarube, it's a postulation at the moment, a hypothesis, that the areas that were hit hardest in the first wave, our hypothesis is, and we've proven it with some community surveillance when we did the antenatal survey blood and the HIV routine service blood, that in places like Khayelitsha there was a higher prevalence of antibodies for COVID than in other comparable areas after the first wave. So our hypothesis is that there were more inherent immunity in the areas that were hardest hit in the first wave, therefore a lower impact in the second wave. And obviously we need to back that up by science. So again, a community survey of antibodies would be the only way that you can scientifically prove that that is the situation. The measures to relieve healthcare pressures, I mean, there's two big ones that we do. The one is the home delivery of medicines. It's a system that's completely automated, and people don't have to come to the hospital to come and just collect medication. That takes a lot of pressure off the healthcare system. And the second one is that we have also instituted telemedicine, that is calling people. There's a call center, there's a call system, and we are going to launch a program that we actually want to consult people at home prior than them coming into our facility, and that's something that we're going to work very hard on in terms of that. That's besides the fact that we have a very systematic de-escalation and wherever possible do healthcare services away from our facility to be able to bring that relief in that regard. The oxygen issue that has been asked, we are working with Afrox. We learned a lot from Afrox. The only other company in the country that has even close to the capacity that Afrox got is a company called Air Liquide. They have contracts in this. Only the two big ones. Any other engineering or generating capacity will have to be scaled up, and it's not going to be to give oxygen in the short term. So we have worked very closely with Afrox and with Air Liquide and the national team on this, and there is a national team looking at oxygen supply for the country now, and our experience is feeding into that. In a vaccine program, definitely we're onboarding our districts. We have a very well-oiled system that if we have vaccines in our Cape Medical Depot, it reaches, whether it's Beaufort West or George or Fredendale, it reaches it exactly the same way as it reaches Guguletu. We have a very clearly streamlined system in our system, and that will be exactly the same here. We definitely will be using the two-dose regimen, and we're expecting that that's what SAPRA will tell us. Then in terms of the new COVID admissions, being higher, the pressure in the hospitals, the shortage of staff, the specific question about Stellenbosch Hospital, and then the ICU in Grootskeer and Tigerberg, and then the recovery rate. I'll do a general comment in relation to that. Our mitigation plan has very much been on, and I think member Jacobs, Dr. Jacobs, you also raised that issue, is that we're investing in capacitating the infrastructure in existing infrastructure. So we have brought online additional beds in existing wards by refurbishing them, putting reticulation in, and for potential future use. So it's an investment for future use. That's on the infrastructure way. Our team has done a lot. We've learned a lot about the reticulation of old reticulation systems in some of our schools, where out of this learning we need to replace them so that we have brand new reticulation systems for the future. But when it comes to the pressure on the hospitals, our plan has been to be able to bring online the capacity so that we can relieve pressure on the acute hospital. That's why we have Hospital of Hope in Brackengate, that's why we have Hospital of Hope in Mitchell's Plain, that's why we brought additional places like Saunstraal, Harrikamay, so that you bring a bit of pressure off the system for the existing system to cope better with what it is. Then that includes Stellenbosch Hospital, because the Stellenbosch Hospital additional capacity has been brought into Stellenbosch Hospital themselves, and together with the fact that Stellenbosch Hospital also can refer patients to Saunstraal if the patients become too much. So Stellenbosch has actually coped quite well with the numbers, and they've constantly been looking at what the need is, and we have a daily update on the daily dashboard of what they need. The Grootskeer and Tigerberg ICU bed is at the pressure. The big rate limiting step for ICU care is nursing staff and doctors to be able to staff ICU care. It's not ventilators, it's not all the other things. And we have worked very much with our capacity to be able to do that. That's why there was a question asked about the gift of the givers, donation. That's why CPAP machines is part of our regimen. We accepted all those machines also from national. It's also dependent on the availability of oxygen, whether we can bring those alternatives with high flow oxygen into the system. So that's how we've dealt with all of those issues. And the recovery rate for healthcare workers is 88% as we speak. And obviously as more people recover out of this active 1,000 cases, we expect that to go back into 90% and above 90%, because at the end of the first wave, we got back to about 96% recovery rate for healthcare workers. So that is what's working, and that dashboard you see gets updated every day, and it will be updating for the next couple of months. I think the issue about the mistrust and the reality on the ground, and that the high fatality rate in the population, and what are we doing for third and fourth wave, and then the deaths, where it's broken down into districts, I think from the member that raised that specific issues, I welcome the fact that you live in the Western Cape. I would genuinely invite you, if you have a lived experience of anything, of any healthcare service, you can write an email to me, you can contact me. I respond to people saying to me, this is what's happening in this area. In every geographic area, we have people that is responsive to the lived experience of people on the ground. And let me just come to the fatality rate. We can't speak about fatality rates in other provinces. The only thing we can speak of is we go to the MRC, and the MRC quantifies what is excess death. We validate our figures against them. I cannot make comments about the fatality rate in Gauteng or in any other province. I can only talk about the death that we know is in the Western Cape. And it's in terms of that, we are pretty confident that what we reflecting back to you is pretty accurate, because our data tries to follow through and find every single person that has died of COVID. And the analysis, as I said to you, is very much driven by age. It's very much driven by comorbidities, and that's why Dr. Jacobs asked the question about diabetes and the other members, because we know that those are the comorbidities that's driving mortality in this province. And our analysis show us what it is we need to do to be able to mitigate mortality from other diseases in future. Your late presentation, I could fully agree with you. If people don't know what the signs are, how to manage, that is something that we learn from this. For third and fourth wave, we definitely need to have that information. I'm COVID positive, I've got somebody in my house, how do I manage that person? We have something called Pack Home. We've asked the UCT Knowledge Translation User Unit. is really about getting that into community workers' arms. It's a very useful kit. It's designed for a community health worker to guide somebody in a home to say, if the members want access to PACO, I can forward those to them as well. It's very clear. It's very illustrative. The idea is we need to have that in every community so that people know that this is what you do about COVID. Then just a few last things about the phase one plan. It will be made available if the committee requires it. It will be made available. Our expert team is looking at the consent form. It's exactly why we need an expert committee. So that we're very clear that ethically what we ask on that consent form has gone through an ethical lens of an expert committee in terms of that. And then vaccination will always be a voluntary activity. That's why a consent form is built in. Nobody can force anybody to take a vaccine against their will. And we would like the information to be of such a nature that everybody understands and can make an informed decision, and that the bulk of people make the decision to take the vaccine in the best interest of themselves and for their community because of the benefit is. We currently have 18 clinical Cuban doctors. They've worked very well in the convention center when it was firstly there. We've deployed them to Brackengate. We've deployed them to the districts in Garden Route and in other places across the province. They're an integral part of our clinical team. The value they've added as being part of our clinical team is they've worked integrated with what our team does in terms of this. We also have 10 other Cuban deployees that is not doctors. It's people that were assisting us with data analysis and all of those. And there were also people assisting us in the technical, architectural, and engineering sphere in relation to that. Then I already said the gift of the givers fund donation has been accepted by us. It is for high flow nasal. It's for CPAP machines. We also got that donation from the National Department. It's all dependent on very clear criteria from our clinicians if that is to be used, how it should be used for better clinical outcomes for patients. And then AstraZeneca, the comment is well taken by the acting chairperson, Dr. Jacobs. It is the Serum Institute product that's based on the AstraZeneca vaccine. That is what we have purchased in this country. The minister can comment on our direct contact. Sorry about that. Our direct contact with other suppliers. As a health department, we've not made any contact with any other suppliers. We're working, as you see, in support of the central procurement from the national department. But the minister can comment on that in terms of the premier's engagements with potential suppliers. Then just lastly, the question of access to medical care, specialized medical care in this province. I can say that this province, we probably pride ourselves on years and years of access to specialized medical care. We have a very good network and a system of being able to have access to specialist medical care. Anywhere where you live in this province, if you need it, you can be referred and you can find a specialist, and the specialist even reaches out to towns. So if you live in Beaufort West, you have access to specialist care in George. Even there, the specialist from George can have an outreach to Beaufort West. If you live in Overberg, you have access to specialist care in Worcester. The specialists from Worcester do outreach into Overberg. The same goes for the West Coast. You have access to specialist care in Palm. Specialist care do outreach on the West Coast. And it's obviously in the metro, there's lots of specialist care in relation to that. Then, just lastly, SAPRA will pronounce on the side effects of the vaccine, and that will be part of the scientific information that will come out of the SAPRA thing. And then the staffing for healthcare workers, Dr. Jacobs. As I said to you, we are taking in short contracts and people like this. But the big plan for us is we are going to have, let's call it this way, a very intentional program of healing for healthcare workers in this province. We are going to take it that we need to have debriefing. We need to take that we have to have individual and collective mourning. We also have to say that people need to be open up the hurt and the trauma. and we are going to build systematically a recovery out of that. We are not, no intention that we're going to rush that, and we will do it with our staff, and we will walk that path with the staff. And then just the last thing, we have the infectious diseases epidemiologists. They have learned from the first wave. We've learned a lot from the second wave. We will do the modeling within the next 4 weeks about the potential third and fourth wave, and we will then say what is our preparatory plan. But very much, as you say, Dr. Jacobs, is to leverage for legacy in relation to the plans and the existing infrastructure that we have. Sorry I had to rush through all of that, but I hope I've done justice. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Does the MEC want to say anything really shortly?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Shortly about the supplier. The Premier, in his capacity as a provincial command council for the COVID, has been engaging with the suppliers and also with the various also other stakeholders in regard to the issue of the vaccine. Why is crucial for that? It's about we know for sure that there will be time where there might be an extra need to expand if need be, even beyond of some of the priorities that the national has provided. So therefore, it is crucial for that. Taking note, Chair, that with the experience with the other vaccines, the child immunization, TB medication, the ARTs for the HIV and other medicines, we have always had that centralization of those. And then if something there happens in regard to where there's been challenges, we always make the point that we always have plenty, so that is crucial. And then lastly, Chair, in regards to the compliance, we urge all other sectors, because it is the role of society, the role of government, especially to close the tap. So the hospitals basically are just mopping the floor, but 40,000 of the actual positive cases, they are outside the health system. So that's why we urge other sectors, the economic sector in regard to the business, and the MPs, honorables, as you do, some of these are in your constituencies, so that it was able to help us to close the gap. With the issue of the sector that is happening, that might have an impact, especially that the vulnerable people help us to absorb it. Same applies with the alcohol. We urge the sectors and everyone else to engage with the also alcohol industry. It shouldn't be only left within the health space. It's everyone's business. Thank you, Chair. I'm looking at the time now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me thank the MEC and the HOC and the Department of Health of the Western Cape. I also want to thank the members who have participated today at the meeting. I'm certain we have a better idea of what is happening in the Western Cape now currently and what you're planning for the future. There are three things which were requested. One is that you share your phase one vaccine plan with the portfolio committee, and also the second one was to share your consent form. And I think it would just be nice if you could actually do that, since it was a request, specific request. The third one is I was involved with a challenge that Honorable Sukas is having. It was an outflow from the challenge that she was having with regards to a family member of hers, that I picked up the challenge with regards to oxygen in the province and nationally, which then made me research it. So I appreciate that you had sent on the chat group that you sent a message to Honorable Sukas HOD that she can contact you. It would be appreciated if you could have a look into the challenge that she's having. And, you know, I take to heart this, what she is saying, that the challenges are more than what maybe is expressed here today. But please do. And thank you very much again to everyone. We will always be in time. So if there's nothing else, I'd like to close the meeting. I'm just going to give an opportunity for anybody who wants to have anything else to say. I guess that's the end of our meeting. We've come to an end of it. Thank you very much to everybody.
Chair,
well and stay safe.
Chair,
Chairperson. I'm sorry.
You've got a minute, Honourable Tukas.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to ask for the stats that we asked for in terms of the number of deaths, if that can be sent to us, please.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure the HOD would have noticed that. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Chairperson, a very, very quick question.
I cannot open the entire floor, but you may very large. You must seconds.
Thank you very much. I know the HOD said to us, it was giving us an email address. Is there any contact number that we could speak to get immediate intervention whenever there's a problem or a crisis? I have been speaking to the office of the MEC and they have been helpful. But we need a contact number of somebody, so whenever there's a crisis, we can contact them immediately. But it takes too long to send an email, wait for a response. That is my feeling. Thank you.
What I would suggest, because we do have a central contact number, but the best is just to understand what's the best way to do it, and we will then give a number from our side that is a convenient number to contact. So let me just, I can come back to you with a specific number of where people can contact, because we have various numbers for various things. So we just need to make sure what exactly the need is and that we have the best possible way to actually meet your need. So let me follow up outside the meeting with that.
Thank you very much. And I guess maybe to other members also. All right. That's it. Our meeting is closed, everyone. Thank you once again. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.